This episode of the Rick Emerson Show is made possible by our good friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
Tell you what, let me go in there first, okay? I'll cover for you. Give you a little more time out here, relax.
Okay.
All right?
I'm Anita Horgarth.
Buck melanoma. Molly Russell's wart. I'm sorry, uncle. Maisie Russell's uncle. I'm her uncle. her mother set up this conference with you.
I'm assistant principal here, as you've probably noticed from the indications on the door.
This door?
The outer door.
The outer door?
Yes.
Because there's nothing on this one.
That's just about enough of that.
Sorry.
I've been an educator for 31.3 years, and in that time, I've seen a lot of bad eggs. I say eggs because at the elementary level, we are not dealing with fully developed individuals. I see a bad egg when I look at your niece. She is a twiddler, a dreamer, a silly heart. She is a jabberbox. And frankly, I don't think she takes a thing in her life or her career as a student seriously.
She's only six.
That is not a valid excuse. I hear that every day, and I dismiss it.
I don't think I want to know a six-year-old who isn't a dreamer or a silly heart. And I sure don't want to know one who takes their student career seriously. I don't have a college degree. I don't even have a job. But I know a good kid when I see one. Because they're all good kids. Until dried-out, brain-dead skags like you drag them down and convince them they're no good. You so much as scowl at my niece, or any other kid in this school, and I hear about it, and I'm coming looking for you. Take this quarter. Go downtown and have a rat gnaw that thing off your face. Good day to you, madam.
It is 22 minutes after the hour of one in this, the month of Geektober. In the year of our Lord, 2010, thank you for coming by and joining us on this Tuesday. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, America's new home for fun and amusements. Thank you for joining us. The Emerson News Network, an entertainment concern since slightly earlier this year. It is 503-505-6964 if you'd like to join us, be part of the program telephonically or, you know, whatever. 503-505-6964 if you'd like to be part of today's program. Your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, conventions, whatever it is you might have. 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Dawn Taylor can be reached at Dawn, that is D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com. Dawn at rickemerson.com. And the text box is open as well. That is rickemerson.com for the text box. And then you can also Skype, direct us with the... Here's the thing is, I'm just going to start mentioning two of these every day. I'm just going to abandon this whole facade that I'm going to remember to do all of them, because it's like seven different ways. So
you can write a message on a baby and just leave it on a street corner.
Please don't do that. We're just using that as a sort of, that's an exaggerated example of the kind of thing that people might do to try to contact us.
I'm just wondering, did that print?
You've got to quit obsessing about the printer. You don't.
It's the taser watch. I have to have the taser watch.
You don't have to have it right now.
No, but if it didn't print, then
I'll get it for you later.
But you can't get it.
You're doing
me if
that
it didn't
thing
print.
Again. You're okay. Here's the thing: if it printed right now, or if it didn't print right now, that's not going to change in the next like 5 seconds.
Okay, but I wasn't. I wasn't.
Stop
stressing.
Dwelling.
I wasn't upset.
Stop.
Okay. I was just doing my job, damn it.
Here's the thing. The printer's uncooperative. You just got to accept that fact, baby. You can't make the printer work more efficiently. The printer, here's the thing you got to note on. The printer is the weak link in the office information chain. If there's anything in the office that's going to screw you, it's going to be the printer. You know that that's the case.
That's right.
So the more you went, as I think a sex therapist would tell you, Don, you can't force it. You just got to relax and let it happen naturally. If you try to just will the printer into giving you the document you need, like right now, it's not going to happen.
Just hit send and then lie back and think of England.
That's the thing. Yes, exactly. Like Catherine the Great did. You've got to just relax and just let it flow organically, Don.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
It's 503-505-6964. That is the way to contact us via the telephone. Coming up later on today, we have the Taser Watch, presuming it prints.
Maybe.
We have the Clergy Watch coming up today as well. We also have another installment of the greatest songs ever made. We'll get to that a little bit later on in the program. We'll also talk about our Geek-O-Lantern carving contest, for which I saw the logo last night. Cheryl Kenneco has put together a Geek-O-Lantern logo for the... Because we're going to post them all online. It's going to be in a gallery.
She is positively magical.
She really is.
The many, many things that she is able to do for us.
I picture her sitting at home sort of like Vishnu, where she's got multiple arms coming out, you know, at any moment, just sort of creating any number of things all at once. So we'll post those later on this week and throughout the month as we begin receiving submissions for that. So we get a whole pile of things from thinkgeek.com. And by pile, I mean this box over to my right. We have four different items from ThinkGeek. And in addition to all that, we got the $100 gift certificate ready to be given away. So here's how you qualify for that. You just carve yourself a jack-o'-lantern, a pumpkin, in a using any sort of a design that falls underneath the broad umbrella of geek. You send that to contest@rickemerson.com. That is contest@rickemerson.com, and those got to be received by the end of Monday. That is by midnight Monday on the 25th of October.
Now,
so
does
midnight.
It have... Oh, I'm sorry. Does it have to be a pumpkin? Like, what if they carved, say...
What's not a jack-o'-lantern otherwise?
Well, they could carve a huge zucchini, say, or a large yellow squash.
What would you
or
possibly...
a watermelon.
What would you carve out of a large zucchini except for Jabba the Hutt? That's really the only thing you can make there. That's it. I mean, not that I'm not open to suggestions. I mean, I'm willing to expand my mind.
But we are going for the classic jack-o'-lantern that we are looking for pumpkin-based entries only.
Isn't that the... Well, maybe I'm wrong about this. Does a jack-o'-lantern... Does it have to be out of a pumpkin to be a jack-o'-lantern? Is that what a jack-o'-lantern means? Or is a jack-o'-lantern any sort of gourd-type product that has been fashioned into a sort of a tableau?
Indeed, that is the question.
Do you know?
I don't know. The home I was at, we made one out of a watermelon 1 year. And I will say they don't last as long as when you carve them out of pumpkins.
When you say the home you were at, was that like the Fletcher Memorial Home, or was that a sort of was that a home for wayward youths?
Kind of.
Or is that just like
when you
grow up?
No, it was the dirt baggy house I was living at with a bunch of punk rock musicians.
Yeah, no, I think that's the thing where you were just stoned probably and didn't have access to a pumpkin at the time.
Someone just huffed some whipped cream out of the canister and went, watermelon!
I don't know. It was in a box in the front of the Fred Meyer. I don't know. Let's carve it and see what happens.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess we'll throw open the doors to it. I mean, it's all very subjective anyway. Whatever. I mean, if somebody feels like I'm just saying it seems like you're biting off a lot there. Because carving a pumpkin, you know, into something that's interesting, that's not just the stock, like, you know, triangular eyes or whatever. Once you get beyond, like, you know, the very sort of the basic... this sort of weird pointy smiley face thing, like it's beyond my abilities anyway. And the idea of doing that on some sort of irregular surface that's tubular or something is just, it just seems like you're really begging for trouble. But I guess if you're an artist, you know, then hey, have at it.
So we will not disqualify
entrance. You know, as long as it's carved into any a vegetable of some kind, you know, or a fruit, some sort of organic. See, now I'm all off my game. I don't even know if a pumpkin is a vegetable. Is it a vegetable or a fruit?
It's a vegetable.
Are you sure about that?
It's a squash, and squashes are vegetables.
Okay, but tomatoes are fruits, so, you know, you can never really tell what's going on with anything.
Well, our friend Mark the Brit, who apparently has too much time on his hands and so is able to, like, search things for us while we're talking, he says, and I quote, "Throughout Ireland and Britain, there is a long tradition of carving lanterns from vegetables, particularly the turnip, mangelwurzel, or swede."
The mangelwurzel. That's why I don't want to live in Britain. No offense. Hey, have a nice steaming bowl of mangelwurzel, and then go upstairs.
Not until 1837 does jack-o'-lantern appear as a term for a carved vegetable lantern, and the carved lantern does not become associated specifically with Halloween until 1866.
Wait a minute, I don't understand.
Both occurred not in Ireland or Britain, but in North America.
Hold on, I don't get this. When you say that not until 18 whatever did it become a vegetable lantern until when?
Well, there's a long tradition of carving lanterns from vegetables.
Okay.
But it wasn't called a jack-o'-lantern until 1837, and that was here in North America.
All right, okay.
And it wasn't until 1866 that it became specifically associated with Halloween.
All right. But when does it say when it made the transition from just any vegetable to pumpkins?
No.
All right.
But there you go.
I would imagine that that's almost certainly like an American thing, because the American desire just to make things bigger and bolder. And I mean, really, I guess a watermelon can be sizable, but really, a pumpkin is your largest readily accessible vegetable. I mean, I can't really think of can you think right now of a vegetable larger than a pumpkin? I bet you can't.
Mangelwurzel.
You see, you don't
They're
know
huge.
It. You don't even know what that
They're
is.
They're huge. They're like the size of a Volkswagen.
You don't even know what a mangelwurzel is.
It's like a rutabaga the size of a Volkswagen.
Mangelwurzel just sounds like one of those, mangelwurzel just seems like one of those names that would only show up like in an early Woody Allen film or something, as a nefarious school teacher.
And in the springtime, children decorate them with ribbons and dance around them to welcome the coming of the seasons.
Before another long, suicide-filled winter. All right, well, in any event, you are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. Don Taylor is tracking the following stories for you on this Tuesday.
The Beaverton School District is accused of discrimination. There is red toxic sludge flooding Hungarian villages. And a message in a bottle dropped in Florida 16 months ago has been found in Ireland.
Fantastic. So that's all on the way. We'll talk about the Geek-O-Lantern contest again just a bit, so we can clarify all of this. I do have to say that I'm going to try my hardest not to be distracted by this massive cookie that's sitting on the table in front of me.
And I need to tell you about that cookie, which is something that may or may not be interesting to anyone but me.
Here's the thing. It matters to me because I'm going to be eating it. I mean, it's the size of a plate. It's huge. So is this one of the cookies you sell through Big Ass Sandwiches?
Yes, it is. And I made a bunch for Big Ass Sandwiches. These are the chewy ginger cookies. Mm-hmm. And I've been having a problem with them lately that they've been too soft. And it's not really that I mind them being a little soft, but that they don't, like, transport well, and I worry about them breaking and bending and stuff while they're storing them, you know, for sale. And so what I did with these, and I was thinking specifically of you at this point, because I know you enjoy a crispy cookie.
Well, I do.
What I did was I had made them, I had set them up, they had cooled and sat for a day, but they were still a little too soft. So what I did was I fired the oven back up, put them back on the silicone baking sheet in the baking pan, put them back in the oven for another 10 minutes, then pulled them out, let them cool again, and they are delightfully crispy and chewy. Both. They are the absolute perfect texture now.
Here's the thing, and now you're saying that, so really, I mean, I feel like I got to get a photo of this. I'll put this up in the gallery. You can go to rickemerson.com/pictures, and you can see today's visual aids. Now, it's not up there yet, but I feel like I got to put this the photo of this cookie up, because this, I'm not trying to put pressure on you, because I haven't tried it yet. I mean, I actually, it's just still sealed in here. This cookie is actually still sealed in the Ziploc bag. This is a strong bag, too. This is a quality Ziploc bag.
Yeah, I bought the... I think
this is like a freezer bag or something.
I think that's the freezer bag.
Here's the thing. This cookie looks perfect. I mean, I almost don't even want to try it. I'm not saying it can't live up to my expectations. I'm saying once I take a bite out of it, then it's going to be ruined. I mean, this is exactly what a cookie should look like. I mean, it's massive. And it's got, you know, and it's sort of lumpy in just, you know, in just the way that a cookie ought to be. Because if a cookie has a sort of uniform thinness or thickness to it, or if the top is too smooth, then, you know, it just came from a factory.
Yeah.
It's just somebody just stamping it out on an assembly line, sort of Ford style. And also, you know, it's got the varying degrees of darkness to it, which means, as you said, that it's sort of, you know, that parts of it are crisp and parts of it are chewy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But I'm such a fetishist for cookies in some ways that it's like, I'm not going to eat it now. I'm not even going to eat it after the show. I have to wait till I go home because it has to be accompanied by milk.
So the listeners are going to be are not going to get.
I'll try part of it here. I'll try a bite of it, and then I'll eat the rest at home. I am as dorky and as much as this makes me sound like Opie. I really find it difficult to consume cookies without milk. It's just the thing that it's almost physically impossible for me to do. Not because I have like an OCD thing about it. It's really not. It's not like it's some sort of routine or ritual. It's just that the combination of the two is so much better. I mean, that is like the definition of more than the sum of its parts. I mean, you got your milk, you got your cookie. Either of them, fine. Together, I mean, it's like nirvana on earth. So anyway, I'll wait and I'll try that a little bit later on. Taser Watch coming up today. Clergy Watch coming up. We'll have another installment of the greatest songs ever made. But just to clarify the Geek Lantern thing, because I know I'm getting questions about it in the text box. So today is Tuesday, October 5th. Now, I know some folks are time shifting this or listening to it later on or whatever. We will accept entries in the Geek Lantern Carving Contest through Monday, October 25th. So that is until midnight. October 25th. And the reason we're not going all the way to like Halloween or whatever with it is because then it gives us a couple days to sort of look at everything, is weigh all the entries. And I think the way we'll do it is we got four items from thinkgeek.com. We got the Star Trek communicator, we got the USB TARDIS, we got the 11th Doctor Sonic screwdriver, and we have the Star Trek tricorder, in addition to which we have a $100 gift certificate to ThinkGeek. And so I think what we'll do is we'll find like the top four or five people, whatever, and we'll just have them sort of bring their Geek Lanterns into the studio, and we'll just sort of judge them kind of in person. It seems like it's going to be the best way to do it. And then they'll all go into an online gallery. So,
well, what if they're far away though, and they can't actually come into the studio?
That's a good one. Somebody asked me that too. A guy said that he was listening to us in Idaho, and he said, "Well, I'm in Idaho. How am I to proceed with this?" And I guess we'll just have to cross that bridge when we come to it. I think
we have to accept long-distance entries.
The majority of people listening to us are within the city limits, but not everybody. So I think if we get to the point where we're picking something, I think we should base things on their merits. And then if it turns out that some guys listening to us, like in Sussex or whatever, then, you know, we'll have to handle it at that point. But for the meantime, you send your submissions to contest@rickemerson.com. And as we decided earlier, it doesn't necessarily have to be with a pumpkin. It could be with any with a squash, a yam, perhaps. If you really want to try to carve something into a turnip or perhaps a radish, if you just want to be a show-off, like one of those name on your grain of rice kind of guys.
Mangelwurzel,
sure. You send all that to contest@rickemerson.com. That is contest@rickemerson.com. Speaking of all things this show-oriented, we want to acknowledge our fine sponsor and business partner, The Cleaning Solution. That's Mr. Michael Beatty, proprietor of The Cleaning Solution, 971-533-3211. One of the folks who helps make this show possible. We will talk about him more later on in the program. It's 503-505-6964. If I sound, by the way, if I sound marble mouth or mush mouth in any way as I'm doing the show, and it was happening last hour too a little bit. So I did this thing. I injured in the last 24 hours. I have injured myself, and when I say myself, my mouth, I have sustained two mouth injuries, both of them involving pieces of bread, which just makes me feel like, I mean, there are a few things that'll make you feel more fragile than injuring yourself with food or while you're eating. I mean, it's one thing if you're just jabbing yourself with a fork.
Yeah.
You know, if you're like carving something and then you, like, I've done the thing where I'll have a fork full of food being put into my mouth, and then I'll bite down. I'll miscalculate when to bite, and then your teeth close on the fork. Mm. And it's, you know, even if you don't chip your teeth, like, it just has that weird electrical feeling that goes through your body. You know, or you can bite the inside of your mouth when you're eating. Sometimes you'll go to chew up your food, and then you'll just, you know, you bite your tongue, or you bite the inside of your cheek, or you bite the inside of your lip, and then it just swells, and then it's the thing you're biting over and over again.
Well, I hope you at least hurt yourself on, like, sharp toasted bread.
Well, here's the thing. So last night, we had this baguette at the house. Let me ask you a question. Did you know this whole thing that it's bad luck to bring a whole baguette into the home?
No, I didn't know that.
Okay. It was the thing I heard the other day, and it was like, I'd never heard it before, but then I looked it up. Apparently, it's just a thing that is known. That if you have a baguette, like if you know, and a baguette is the long, skinny loaf of bread.
Uh-huh.
It's the thing that's always sticking out of the top of grocery sacks in movies. People are always coming home from the market, and they've either got floured celery, or they've got a baguette sticking out the top.
Or daisies.
So that you know they've been at the store.
Right.
So the baguette, apparently, when you before you even cross the threshold of your house, you're supposed to have taken a bite of or torn a piece off of the end of the baguette. If you bring a whole baguette into your home, bad luck. The worst luck imaginable,
well,
apparently.
And I don't buy that because I think most people bring whole baguettes into their house.
Well,
so therefore, maybe that's why our economy is in such bad shape.
I was just going to say, we're facing a lot of problems in this fading republic, Dawn, and now I think we've figured out the answer.
Unemployment, it's because of people bringing whole loaves of bread into their houses.
So I have this. So Laura actually, she purchased this baguette, this big loaf of bread, and she brought it home. Because I'm nuts for bread. I mean, just the bread-type products, anything that is sort of bread-like or bread-ish, I will consume. And she had it there, and I was just sort of slowly consuming it over the course of the week. And then I had that thing where it's like I had, you know, maybe, I don't know, 4 inches of bread left, which is, you know, because it's not sliced, obviously. You're just sort of tearing it or you're cutting it or whatever. So I think 4 inches of bread, and I had that thing happen where I picked it up, and I was actually really, I was just feeling peckish, as they say, not really hungry as such, but just feeling like I want a little something, a little nosh. And so I picked up this just like the butt end of the baguette, just the final end of it. And I brought it up to my mouth, and I actually hesitated for a moment, thinking, is this too large to comfortably fit inside the cavernous maw that is my mouth? And time seemed to slow for just a second as I was sort of weighing whether or not I could consume. And then, of course, I just jammed the entire thing into my mouth. And I found that what happened is the whole section of bread was actually too large for my delicate, girlish mouth. And as I put it in, and I got the bread about halfway into my mouth, and what did I do? Did I just say, like, this isn't fitting, I should just take it out and just try again? Or maybe just, you know, use my teeth to bite off a section of the bread.
Mm.
No, I just decided to jam the entire thing into my mouth. So there I am, just shoving the bread into my mouth like I'm shoving commuters into a Japanese subway. There's a guy outside with a plunger just going, heave! Cool! Shoving the entire baguette into my mouth. By the way, I'm lucky I didn't just kill myself choking. I mean, what an embarrassing way to die, where somebody comes in and there's a baguette jammed into your mouth. You just look like Luca Brasi or something, like somebody has killed you. I don't know, this is bad news. They've left a baguette sticking out of his mouth. It means we're supposed to drop the money on the north side mailbox or something. So I've jammed the entire thing into my mouth, and then, have you ever done this? And I know you have. Where you shove a piece of food into your mouth, and for a moment, you're really convinced that you are, in fact, going to die because you've cut off the wind supply to your lungs. And you are simultaneously really afraid of death, and yet, at the same time, an equal, if not greater, fear is the shame that will ensue when they come in and they find you with, you know, whatever, like you've just jammed a little Debbie snack cake or something, or like a zinger into your mouth. And you're like, oh, they're going to find me with a zinger in my... and that really becomes your will to live right there. Your motivation for surviving becomes that you don't want to find them, you know, you don't want to be found with a tiger tail jammed into your esophagus.
I don't really do that so much. My husband, though, is quite the one for the giant bites of food.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, I've learned over the years that if he asks for a bite of something, particularly if it's something specific, particularly delicious, and something he's been coveting that I have, that I'm better off like tearing off a piece and giving it to him than just handing it to him. Because it's like, okay, I'm allotted a bite. Therefore, I will jam as much of it in my mouth as possible to make that my bite.
Exactly.
And I'm surprised often that he doesn't just like fall down to the ground and I have to do the Heimlich on him.
It really is amazing, when you look at that behavior of me, that I've made it to 37. I mean, it really is just... It boggles the mind sometimes. So, anyway, last night, there I am, and so I just jammed the baguette into my mouth. I wish I'd taken a photo of it, but I was so convinced I was going to die.
And you wouldn't want that to be your last photo on your iPhone either if you did die.
It appears that he was taking a photograph of himself as he jammed bread into his mouth. We don't have any explanation for that. I mean, it just sounds effing retarded, right? I mean, both clinically and figuratively. Anyway, so there I am in the kitchen just... And then I'm just so worried that I won't be able to draw life-giving oxygen into my lungs that then I just start chewing the thing and just trying to get it, into pieces so I can either swallow it or get it out of my mouth. Anyway, but lost in the shuffle of all this is the fact that I have taken a piece of bread that is like 9 inches across, basically, and I've just jammed it into my gullet. And so I did this thing, and I know you've had this pain. It's like a paper cut, but worse. I've actually cut the corners of my mouth.
Oh, God.
Because it's a hard-crusted bread.
God.
I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know why I didn't just eat a smaller piece. I mean, why didn't I just take a bite of it? I've got teeth. It's not like I have to gum my food.
No, and it's not like you were trying to keep it away from predators.
No. I have to consume it so that I can pass on my family line. No.
The bear will take it away from me if I don't just jam it all in my mouth.
No, I mean, the only thing in the house that would take it from me is a poodle, and I'm taller than he is. So, anyway, so I'm just, you know, shoving it in my mouth. And so, yeah, if you look at the corners of my mouth, the corners of my mouth is actually, I've actually been injured by this hard-crusted baguette. Anyway, so that was last night. So you think I would learn my lesson, but of course I'm a man, so I don't learn. I'm a guy, so therefore I'm dense. So this morning, I'm running around the house, and you and I, we weren't, it's not that like we were late getting here as such. It's just that some days we come here early and we prep here in the studio. But some days Greg and Sarah are taping before we do. And so today was one of those days. They were taping here. It's Tuesday morning. And they were taping Fun Employment. And we can either prep in the kitchen or, you know, but it's easier just to, you know, just to do some of the work at home. So I left the the house a little bit later than I intended, because I looked up and I was like, oh, my God, it's 20 after. I better get to work. So, you know, I'm doing that thing of rushing around the house, you know, and sticking all my stuff into a bag. And, you know, and I'm like, okay, you know, I don't want to be late, and jamming all my things into my shoulder bag and getting ready to leave. And then the dog decides he has to go out, and then he decides to take like an hour, you know, and then he's barking at the guy, you know, across the street, and I'm having to corral him. So things are conspiring to push me a little behind. Meanwhile, this whole time, I've realized that I'm not really going to have time to eat here, so I've just taken a piece of bread, and I have this sort of sliced turkey. So I put some slices of turkey and then like some chunks of Swiss cheese on top, stick it in the toaster oven, hit start, take the dog outside. You know, and I figure by the time I come inside, the dog will be, the dog will be done, and then the food will also be ready. I can grab it, get in the car. It's a piece of toasted bread and cheese, and it'll be fine. I can eat it with one hand while I'm driving, whatever. So I come inside. It's not quite done because the cheese hasn't melted. So, you know, I could just eat it anyway. Clearly, I'm not averse to just jamming things into my mouth, whether or not they're ready to be consumed, whether or not I can actually swallow them.
But it wasn't just right.
But yeah, but that's my thing. So coming off last night, where I have proven that I will probably just stick plywood into my mouth if I'm hungry enough, I have to actually retoast the bread because the Swiss cheese isn't quite bubbly enough for me. So I hit start again, and then I'm just standing and waiting for the toast to be done this morning. So I've got one slice of bread, I've got all these strips of turkey on it, and then I've got the Swiss cheese. It finally gets to the point where it's sort of bubbling nicely and it's starting to brown around the edges. Given what you know about my eating habits because of the baguette discussion, what do I do?
You reach in, pull it out of the toaster oven, and just stick it in your mouth.
I reach in, pull it out of the toaster oven, stick it into my mouth. Now, here's the thing about cheese. We had this story last hour about a woman who suffered burns from melted butter. Melted butter and melted cheese really behave much the same way in that fashion. So I immediately, and the thing is, and it's not like a slice of cheese, like a single. I mean, they're like sort of chunks. I hadn't taken the time to use a knife to cut pieces of Swiss cheese. I'd just torn. Shut up. It's not.
You're like a caveman. What the hell?
Here's the thing. My wife is still in town. She's not even gone. She hasn't even left. My wife's going to be out of the country for a month. I won't even just be dead. I'll be in a home because I'll have like lopped off my limbs somehow. I'll be one of those guys like in a wood chipper accident. So I had taken a brick of Swiss cheese out of the... I know this is going on forever, but I mean, yeah. It's just, sometimes the story just can't be minimized. I had taken this brick of Swiss cheese out of the fridge, and I had just, you know, sort of snapped is the wrong... I just torn off chunks of Swiss cheese and put them on top, which is why I had to melt it twice.
Yeah.
So, of course, it's twice as hot, right? But also, it's not level, so it's got these big, like, hills and ranges of Swiss cheese. And so I just say, well, I'm so hungry and late. I better just shove it into my mouth now. And I shove this piece of toast in. But because the Swiss cheese is not of a uniform height, immediately the bubbling, like boiling cauldron cheese, it's like all the surface area of my lips somehow managed to come into, even my lower lip, it felt like, just managed to come into contact with the cheese, which then immediately began burning in my skin. And then I'm doing that thing of, ha! And I'm pulling it back, you know, and then it's a bit like little bits of cheese are stuck to my face. But then I look at it, it's too late. It's like 11:35. I'm like, Christ, I got to leave. So then I get in the car, and it's like the entire way to work, it feels like my lips are on fire. But I can't really stop to check them out in the rearview mirror because I don't get any red lights. So that's the good news, bad news. is I have no red lights happening. So I'm just driving the entire way, not quite able to tell whether or not my face is, in fact, you know, like in flames at that moment, which is what it feels like. So now I'm at the point now. I still really haven't had a chance to, like, even duck into the bathroom today. So it's like I could just be covered in boils and burns for all I know. Am I?
No, you're not.
All right.
I would have noticed that.
I have burned the insides of my lips, though. I mean, thank God it's at least on the inside where only I know my shame. But the insides of my lips are covered with, like, burns and scalds at this point.
Well, I'm not in as bad a shape as you, but I did a similar thing last night where the tip of my tongue hurts today because last night neither Patrick or I felt like cooking dinner. So on the way home, I stopped and I got one of those Papa Murphy's pizzas that you bake yourself in the oven. And so, of course, then you have to bake it at like 425 right. And then you take it out. Then you have to wait because if you cut it too soon, the cheese just all goes bleh, and so we wait just long enough to like cut it because I'm starving. And I get my pizza and I go and sit down and like, yay, and I'm going to watch a little TV and do the thing. And of course, like I pick it up, put the thing in my mouth, and just go, hot, hot, and then chew, 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 swallow. And about 5 seconds go by, and then I take another bite of pizza because I'm starving.
Because it's
then,
magically cool.
Like, hot, hot. So then I take a bite. Then I like, and I blow on the pizza, and then I take a bite. But of course, just blowing on the surface of the pizza does nothing to you know, cool the giant nuggets of sausage that are 400 degrees. And so, again, I'm like, hot! And my husband's sitting over on the couch just watching me like I'm some kind of a retard with, like, attention deficit disorder who, like, can't concentrate for more than 2 seconds before I keep forgetting that it's hot.
You're like Homer when he drops his keys into the deep fryer and he just keeps reaching in after them. Dope out, dope keys. Dope out, dope keys. Well, you know, and the thing of, like, blowing on something to cool it is just so ridiculous anyway, because you're basically just cooling the atoms on top. I mean, like, literally, like the very top, like, molecular layer. It's like when you blow on your coffee. You know, there's, like, 9 inches of coffee below that. You're cooling something that, I mean, that does no good.
No.
You know what that does? That's like pressing the elevator close button or the crosswalk button. It does nothing. They're not even connected, friends. There's wires in there that go to nothing. They just dangle down into the elevator shaft. So I'm glad to know that at least you injured yourself with some food. As well. That's my morning, is I'm just, the whole time, and then I'm just, you know, oh, my delicate, beautiful face, you know. I'm worried that I've just completely covered myself with injuries. It was a whole thing.
Aww.
Jesus. All right. So, speaking of good God Almighty. All right. So, get another text here. Somebody says, once and for all, can I carve a turnip? That's between you and your God. I mean, but have at it. If you're asking me, can you carve a turnip for the? And look, by the way, let's all give it up for the phrase geek-o-lantern, huh?
Yeah.
Come on now, that's a Rick Emerson original. I'm not saying nobody else ever said it. I'm saying I came up with that on my own. Whether or not the phrase pre-existed, it probably did. I came up with that. That was a thing that just came out of the ether, out of the void, out of the darkness.
And yes, you may carve a turnip.
You may carve any vegetable you like. You send that to contest@rickemerson.com. And I don't think I don't know that we'll get any right off the bat because I'm not even sure they're selling pumpkins yet. It's probably early in the month for that still.
I don't even know how that works. I think there's Christmas decorations in the store, so there ought to be pumpkins available.
So you send your geek-o-lantern carving to contest@rickemerson.com for grabs of those 4 great items from thinkgeek.com. You can see those at rickemerson.com/pictures. Also, a $100 gift certificate. Pictures got to be received by the end of Monday, October 25th. So there you go. All right. Without further ado, and by the way, just before we get to the news here, we've been talking a lot about Squires Electric, who are one of our fine new business partners here at the Emerson News Network. And I sometimes say things like, you know, you probably don't want to try to fix that electrical issue yourself. You probably don't want to rewire your entire guest cabana on your own. You probably don't want to just go find out what that strange hissing, sparking thing is behind a control panel. The fact that I could not, in fact, it's not even that I couldn't toast bread correctly. I couldn't even eat the toast correctly. That right there, I'm not saying you're as bad off as I am. The law of averages indicates that you are probably not. But imagine how much damage me in this case. I mean, that's just literally damaging myself with cheese is what I'm doing. Imagine how much damage I could do if I did have like a fistful of electrical cables that I'd taken out of a wall. I mean, it's almost tempting to try to fix something in my house. You know, just to get a pair of pliers and some duct tape, you know, and like a feather duster, and just see if I could rewire my kitchen.
Don't do that.
See, but I won't, because there are cooler minds than mine that prevail. They decide to just step in and stop me from doing that. don't be, Rick Emerson is not a role model. So if there's anything in your house that needs fixing, hell, if it just plugs into something, you might want to think twice about whether you deal with it. But that's what Squires Electric does, is they, you know, they come in and they, did you know this? And I did not. So when it comes to getting your, I want to make sure that I get the phraseology correct here. When it comes to getting your electrical inspector's license, because there's like, you know, there's the apprentice, and then there's like a journeyman, and then you're like a master craftsman. There's a level of, you know, the level of knowledge you get there. But then they actually license you to be like a supervising inspector. Do you know the number of percentage, the percentage of people who fail that test? It's like passing the bar, basically, to get your license.
I do not.
What percentage of people would you think fail their test to become an electrical supervising inspector?
70%.
97%.
Wow.
Joe Squires passed it first time. There you go. And he said it in that way that he says everything, where he's like, you know, he's like, well, I'm just plain people. I'm just folks. You know, I happen to work. I worked in a nuclear submarine. Also, I'm way smarter than you in every way. And I can bench press 350 or, you know, whatever. Yeah, so he passed that the first try. It's a thing, apparently, that almost no one can do correctly. And by people, I probably mean you guys. So
so this is one of those things that to advise others to inspect others, to be able to tell that other people are doing things correctly, you basically have to know everything.
Yeah. I mean, you have to have a brain the size of a truck. So you want to contact Squires Electric at squireselectric.com. 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609. That is how you contact Squires Electric. Electrical wiring of any kind, whether it's installing it, removing it, maintaining it, fixing it. If you got a fire, you got water damage, if you're in fact constructing a building from scratch, they can help you with that as well. If it has to do with wires or wiring in your home or business, they can make your life easier. SquiresElectric.com, 503-252-1609. All right, so here we go. So a cozy 40 minutes late. Let's get to Dawn Taylor at the news desk.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
A student teacher accused the Beaverton School District of discrimination for its response after parents complained he talked about his sexual orientation with a fourth grader. Seth Stambaugh, a graduate student at Lewis and Clark College, was reassigned from Sexton Mountain Elementary School several weeks ago. His lawyer said a student asked why Stambaugh wasn't married, and he replied it was because he was gay. The Beaverton School District said the reassignment was not discrimination. A district spokesman said Stambaugh's conversation was not age-appropriate, and it raised questions about his professional judgment. According to Maureen Wheeler, Beaverton School District spokeswoman, we may be all asked different questions that might be more of a personal nature, and we need to redirect and make sure we're staying on the task of teaching and learning.
So this is what, he was a grade school teacher?
Yes.
Does it specify beyond that?
He's actually a student teacher. He's a graduate student at Lewis and Clark College. Well, what it says is he was assigned to a classroom, and he had several children. He's fourth grade.
Okay, so fourth graders.
And so fourth graders wanting to know if he was married, and no. And then why wasn't he married? And apparently he kept dodging the question for a while, and then finally he just said to one of the students, because men can't marry each other.
Yeah, well, and the thing is, you can't. People always say, "Well, you know, well, you just don't answer the question in that case." But the thing is, kids won't let you dodge.
Right.
If you try to dodge questions, kids, then it just becomes a thing that they obsess on, where they just you know, they keep nagging you about it because kids, you know, kids are naturally they're inquisitive young minds, and so they like to know stuff. I actually read a great article about this last night. It was let me see if I can actually find this because, and if I can't, I'll dig it up later. But there was a great piece. And it was titled the way, like, everything on the internet is titled now, where the title was somewhat irreverent, but it was called, like, 12 Badass Ways to Answer Difficult Questions Your Kid Has or something. But one of the questions was, it was like, you know, well, why does Joey have two dads or whatever? It's like how to answer your kid's question when they ask about somebody. And I forget what they said. This is, you know, for like kids that are like 10 or below. But it was something about, you know, something like something akin, I think, to what your mom told you.
Yeah.
Which is.
She said, you know how men and women fall in love and get married. Well, sometimes men fall in love with other men and want to be with men instead of women.
Exactly. And that was, and it was something very much like that. Because there's a whole, here's the thing about not having kids is I don't have to worry about any of these things. Like, I'm never going to have to answer the, you know, like, you know, why is my pet hamster not waking up? You know, I don't have to. That's just, it's, you know, I don't have to. That's another thing I have to answer. I also don't have to do this. I don't have to do the whole, like, you know, Well, Dad, did you ever abuse your body with drugs or alcohol? Which is the thing that every parent gets asked, and then they all lie about it. Every single one of them. Every single parent on earth lies. They either lie and say they didn't do drugs when they did, or they go, well, I did, and it was wrong. It was a mistake. And by the way, these are usually the same parents that I see later at a poker game who are just like locking and loading the minute they get in the door, you know, where they've got like a 12-foot-high bong that filled with red wine that they're using. So I'm just saying, I don't have to worry about any of that stuff.
Well, speaking of which, I actually have a story here that we can parlay.
Just back on this thing for a minute, though, just one more thing on the teacher. So, but I mean, I hate to bring out the L word, the lawsuit word, but I mean, you think, but that is a thing where you almost feel like he got, what is it, reassigned or?
Yeah, he, because again, he's a student, a graduate student at Lewis and Clark, and so basically they've handled it by they are finding him. They said that they weren't involved in the decision, and they're working with him to find a new school for him to go to complete his student teaching. Now there's a big question about, you know, the Beaverton School District says what they did wasn't discrimination, and I guess there's some argument going back and forth between parents. And
well, what
stuff
sucks about
whether
that
or not it was appropriate.
And the thing is, it goes on his no pun intended, like his permanent record, right? If you're a student teacher and they have to reassign you at some point, or they do, that probably is a thing that you get tagged with. You had to be
possibly
moved from, you know, and plus it's in the news, so it's kind of being whispered about, and the story will probably. And you know, the thing is, by the time some other school hears about this, the story will have morphed into, like, he was telling them how to have gay sex. And so that is almost a thing where he might want to at least be looking at something like that down the road, because there's no other way that he could have handled it.
And what's so offensive about it to me is that they're putting it in the way they're framing it is, you know, that a number of parents and stuff like that in the school district saying that discussions of sexuality are best handled at home. And you're absolutely right. Discussions of sexuality are best handled at home. He did not discuss sex with the kids.
Right.
You know, he said that, you know, he's gay. It's not that, you know, again, you're putting it, basically framing homosexuality as being about men having hot, hot sex with each other. You know, if they ask him, are you married? And he says, yes, I'm married to a lady. He's not talking about sex. But if he says, yes, you know, I can't marry my partner because he's a man, all of a sudden he's talking about something dirty.
Right. Well, that's just code for talking about the politics in a way that doesn't hew to the mean. So, all right. Insert joke here about because we all know marriage and sex have nothing to do with each other. Am I right, guys? Hey now. Okay.
There was a great video that somebody linked to on I can't remember if it's on YouTube where it is, but it's a short film about 15 minutes long that someone made about this girl named Annika and her parents. And she is, you know, basically transgendered, but she's only, I think, like 11 or 12 years old. But she obviously, you know, has this sort of fluid sexuality.
What, she's like it, but like she's like a hermaphrodite or something? Or?
No, she's a girl who basically identifies as a boy.
Oh, okay. All right.
And her parents are... oddly enough, her parents are really supportive of this and have said, you know, she's always been like this. Even when she was a tiny little girl, we tried to put dresses on her and she'd throw them aside.
Right.
And she's kind of they're kind of a chubby family, and she's a chubby girl, and she's kind of big. And she, they're in one of those wintry East Coast or Midwest states, so she plays ice hockey.
Of course.
So, yeah. But the thing is, they're working with the pediatrician, and the pediatrician is giving her, I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it's some kind of a medication that they give, like, when onset of puberty hits really young kids.
So to delay it?
Like two or three, and to delay it. And what they're doing is they're giving it to her basically so she can buy some time intellectually and psychologically until she decides what she wants to do.
Oh, that's interesting.
If she's going to want to transition when she's 18, if she's going to want to, like, finally just say, no, I'm okay the way I am, and I will grow breasts and that sort of thing. But they're buying her a couple of years before puberty so that she can figure out what her own gender is that she's comfortable with.
That's interesting. I was all primed to be pissed off about it, too. But now I'm not. They're meddling with it, but now I'm okay.
Now
I'm on board.
It was really interesting.
All right. Here is Don Taylor.
Let's do our clergy watch.
Here is your clergy watch for Tuesday right here in the Rick Emerson radio program.
Well, I guess it would be nice if I could touch your body. Not every
have faith.
Here is Don Taylor with your Clergy Watch.
Here is Don Taylor.
Sorry, a little bit of feedback there. I'm sorry, I was adjusting a thing. Here's Don Taylor.
A church pastor accused of sexually assaulting a schoolgirl told a jury, "It was a banana in my pocket." David Morris, 60, said the 12-year-old could have mistaken the fruit for his penis as he sat next to her during an English lesson.
His penis, which is yellow and curves abruptly to the left and can be peeled.
The pastor at Carmarthen Evangelical Church in West Wales said he was in the habit of putting a banana in his pocket, and it was possible the youngster had accidentally felt it. Prosecutor Garrett Walters told the court he said one thing he would do from time to time was to carry a banana in his trouser pocket. He said it's possible this is what the girl mistook for his erect penis. The victim, now 26, alleges that Morris placed her hand on his crotch area during a private meeting lesson. Mr. Walters told Morris became quite tactile and touchy during the classes. It progressed to tickling on her hand, arm, and up her back. The court heard that he then took her hand and placed it on his groin, where she felt a lump. The alleged victim and her fiancé arranged to meet Morris years later at a motorway service station to confront him about the allegations. She said he arrived and went to sit down. He stood up and took a banana out of his pocket and put it on the table and then said, "This is what you must have felt."
Really? That's like really the poor man sort of Jedi mind trick kind of. It wasn't my penis. It was this fruit right here.
The woman told court that on the day of the alleged assault, she told her mother about it, but nothing was done apart from her tutoring being stopped.
Did he explain why he would just be carrying a banana around in his pants?
No.
I mean, we were all on the penis thing here, but there's really no plausible reason why you would just choose your pants as the traveling place for a banana.
No.
I mean, maybe like your outer pocket or something. But I mean, really, if that's where the lump is and it's, you know, they think it's your penis, that there's several issues at play there.
She also said that on a different occasion when she was age 12 or 13, Morris took her and her sister underwear shopping after buying them cider at a pub.
Of course he did. All right.
There's a photograph of him, by the way, at rickemerson.com/pictures.
Let me look at it right now. All right. Let me activate that gallery if it has not been activated yet. And this is in Wales?
This is in Wales.
Here's a dumb question. I know this makes me sound like an ugly American, so I mean, you know, I am what I am. Where is Wales?
It's near England.
See, okay. I'm not disputing that. I'm sure that is true. But that's no more information than I had before. I kind of figured it was sort of near England, but I don't really know what that means.
It's in that vague, lumpy kind of continental area over there where England and Ireland and Scotland are.
The vague cottony area?
Continental area.
Oh, okay. Oh, my God, it's Richard Belzer.
Mark the Brit says, "Oh, for Christ's sake, it's on the western side of England."
Oh, whatever. You're from there. It doesn't impress me that you know.
Yeah.
That's like me knowing where Idaho is. You don't get points for that.
I know.
All right. Well, okay. So, yeah, I'm looking at this is basically John Munch. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's more or less who she's, that's more or less who she was allegedly.
He's a chinless British John Munch.
Wow. All right. So there you go. So you can see that at rickemerson.com/pictures. That's where those are. rickemerson.com/pictures. There's your Clergy Watch for Tuesday right here on the Rick Emerson Radio wait for it program. Because I got to have faith. Fantastic. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Still to come, we have your Taser Watch. Later on today, we'll have the installment of the greatest songs ever made and so forth. This is Don Taylor.
A Portland high school principal warned parents about a drug she says is becoming increasingly popular with teenagers. In a letter to parents last week, Lincoln High School Principal Peyton Chapman said students came to her with concerns about a new drug called Sunshine, or Shine.
Okay, wait, don't tell me. I'm going to try to guess what Sunshine is. So this is in what state? Is that here, or is it elsewhere?
That is here in Portland.
Okay, middle school, high school, grade school?
High school.
High school. The students came to, and she's the teacher? She's the principal? She's the principal. Well, first of all, what kind of student, and I think we know the answer. The answer is apple polisher, goes to the principal. What do the students care if there's some new drug out? I mean, it seems like it's a win-win if you're a kid who takes drugs. Not that I'm saying you should do that, but let's be honest. Sometimes there's only so many things to do to amuse yourself on a Saturday. I mean, you know, especially if you're in a small town, you know, hey, what are you going to do? So if you're a kid, if you're some dirtbag kid who takes drugs, then you're all for it because, hey, new drug. If you're not, if you're some, you know, clean living type, then it seems like it's probably a win for you anyway because it's going to be a lot easier for you to become the valedictorian.
Just young Republicans in the making who want to stop other people from having fun.
You know, there was another group of people who informed on their friends and neighbors. They were Nazis. You don't want to be like Nazis, do you? So they went to the principal. How do you suppose they had this discussion? Was it like a bunch of kids? Did they have a meeting? And did they have like a quorum?
Well, she said that she heard from students who were concerned that their friends might be addicted.
To sunshine.
To sunshine.
All right. Is sunshine, is it a pill?
No.
All right. Wait, hold on. No. Is sunshine, Is it an herbal supplement of some kind, like the kind that we seem to hear about every 18 months that authorities are saying is more dangerous than LSD?
No.
Sunshine. Is it acid or something?
No.
I have no idea. What is it?
It is they describe it as a white sparkly powder similar to methamphetamine. Chapman said she first heard about it after a student nearly overdosed in Bend earlier this year. And again, I caution you to take that with a grain of salt. She said, when they said they were worried, I decided to alert the community. I'd rather act in a preventative way than react if it did take hold and become a bigger problem.
Like that Jenkum.
She said she has alerted the school police, Portland Public School Securities, and all faculty to growing concern about the drug. Which, and again, now I have this sort of magical ability to research things that apparently local news outlets and law enforcement don't have,
which is
called Google.
So there is no vast repository of human information, Dawn. You're acting as though there's some way that even a commoner, even a high school principal, would be able to access a database of assembled facts and knowledge.
Yes.
That's just not the case.
But
what did Google say?
I can do this. Well, Google put me, weirdly enough, I was able to find a message board where people who actually do drugs talk to each other about drugs. And what it is most likely is a drug called mifedrone, which has been very popular in Europe.
I know all about that drug.
Yeah. And it's been legal in Europe up until recently. They just recently banned it. It's been called, one of the names for it is Meow Meow.
Yeah. No, this is I heard a whole thing about this, actually. It had one of the coolest names, not Meow Meow, because that's just stupid. someone's calling to tell us about this. Let me just get this phone call, Donna, and I'll tell you all about it. And then you can, you undoubtedly know more than I do, but I have one interesting anecdote. Hello, hi, sir, madam, as the case may be. You're on the, oh, you know, the, this actually, hold on a second. Let me actually turn on my side of it. So forth. All right, hello, you are calling the Rick Emerson radio program. How can I help you on this fine Tuesday? Hello there. Hello, hi. Hello.
Hello.
It was me. I was too late. Too late! Mm-hmm. That was where the phone side of the equation worked. I didn't have my side of the equation actually turned on. All I know about this is actually not that much. One is that it had a really bad name called Methadrone, which is exactly what I would, like, if I had, like, some sort of drone metal band, you know, or like if I formed some sort of, like, Queen to the Stone Age type band, it would totally be called Methadrone.
Well, it's Methadrone, though, with a P, not a T.
Right, but I'm saying the other way sounds cooler. Oh. Like, if I had a band, though. Yeah. I'm not saying for the drug. I'm saying if I was going to rock.
Oh, all right.
If I was getting some other dudes and I were going to go storm the stage and kick ass, Don.
Okay.
As I do sometimes. We would be called Methadrone. And we play a lot of, like, spooky, doom-laden metal in the, you know, in the style of Typo Negative. But then they said, like, the drug, also known as Meow Meow, and then they interviewed this, I don't mean to sound like a dick, grieving parents whose idiot kid had just decided to ingest a bunch of this stuff and it died. And they were talking about how it was technically legal because it skirted the pharmaceutical laws, blah, 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 blah. And then the mom was just going, and I never thought that our son would die from Meow Meow, and I just kept laughing. And Lara kept saying, she's like, I'm trying to hear the story. And I'm like, but it's so ridiculous. And I was lowering my voice like the parents could magically hear me. But, I mean, how is it stupid to say that your kid died from Meow Meow overdose? Yeah. I mean, it just sounds like your kid jammed his esophagus full of Sanrio dolls or something.
Well, yeah, it's a white powder. It's been very popular in Europe for a while. It's sold as plant food, so they can get around the medicinal laws.
What is it like, though?
Apparently, it seems like it's a little like ecstasy. There was a piece in, I think it was The Guardian. Yeah, it was The Guardian, where a doctor actually tried it. He went and bought some because it's like the salvia herbal.
Right, right.
You know, except what it is it's a research chemical, which means that it's not anything that's ever been manufactured for prescription use, nor is it a natural substance.
So there are no laws against it.
So yeah, but it's But yeah, so they've been able. And you snort, you draw out a couple of lines, you snort it, and then what he said it was kind of awesome, but it was like ecstasy. He immediately looked at his friend who was like, "I love you. Let's go out to a club and dance." And they went out to some nightclub and danced for 2 hours, and then the drop off was almost immediate after
right.
2 hours, where it's like suddenly it was gone and he had a pounding headache. But he said that while he was on it, it was actually
the best thing ever.
Sorry to say, it was actually great.
See, stories like this just make me want to pencil drugs in as like a line item on our budget here.
But despite the fact that that there are, of course, there are always stories whenever there's some new thing that people are doing that's having fun. Think of like Dungeons and Dragons. Mm-hmm. There's always these stories about like a teenager committed suicide when they were on this drug and somebody. Apparently, there are actually. They don't seem to be any like real hardcore side effects that anybody knows about. On the other hand, there hasn't been any research into what long-term effects there might be, but it's highly likely this is what it is. And again, I found this out by just typing in, you know, the information on the internet.
I view all of these drugs as being sort of like LASIK. You know, it's just like maybe they work as advertised, maybe they don't. Maybe there's side effects, maybe there aren't. You know, but I'm going to wait. I'm going to give it like 10 years, and I'll see what happens to other people who try it. And then if everything's fine and dandy, then great. But you know, but if they're walking around and their eye just deflates like a bad football, then you know, I'll know not to do that. All right, you're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. This text messenger says. Several things. I read a couple of these. Says, I have a visual now of you just stuffing a whole loaf of bread into your face without using, what do you call them? Teeth. Yeah, those. chew, 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 swallow is the best phrase ever. And then this just says, can we get a pee break soon, please? Yes. Yes, you actually can. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program right here on the Emerson News Network. Still to come, another installment of the greatest songs ever made, Taser Watch, and more. You stay there. This is the Rick Emerson Show. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to The Rick Emerson Show. This is the Emerson News Network.
You know, Don, just listening to you describe that story about the sunshine the kids are all on, I am reminded that it sometimes is like kids speak a different language altogether.
What language would that be?
See, I was trying to... I had step A there in that segue, but steps B and C just eluded me.
Step three, profit.
Something... Yes, actually. It's strange that you put it that way. Figuratively and literally, yes. Well, and I was trying to do a whole thing with Castalia language, and it didn't really come together the way I was trying to. Anyway, here's a website you ought to know about. That website is PortlandSpanish.com. PortlandSpanish.com. You know how, like, Heather has two mommies? Okay. My wife, who I think is not listening right now, my wife has two uncles. One uncle is like...
I don't think that's the same thing at all.
No. I'm just saying. It's just it's an amusing play on words that I'm going to use.
One is a funny uncle, and they live together.
I'm just, I'm just using the similarity in phrases as a sort of comedic tool to get to the larger point, which is that she has these two uncles, and I was going to say this may be the same in your family, but I've learned that almost nothing is the same in your family, Don. But she's got these two uncles, and it's like, you probably have seen this, where they're about the same age, and it's like, you know, they have the same dad and whatever, but one of them, you know, still real smart, real sharp, he's like 89 years old, I think. His most recent purchase, he's all about, the last time I went to Utah, he was like telling me all about the difference between the plasma TV and the LCD TV in terms of widescreen. And then he took out, I swear to God, like a manual of schematics that he downloaded from the internet. He's like, well, I went on the internet and I went to Google and I downloaded a PDF that shows the schematics of the Samsung LCD. And then I put it right next side to side with the Hitachi plasma screen. And you can see here that the pixelation burnout rate on the plasma screen, and he's like 1,000 years old. And he just bought a Nintendo Wii as well. And so, you know, the thing is not making it sound like Bruce Agler, but he said, you know, I love this Nintendo Wii. It's got a fantastic processor. The motion sensing is really amazing. And I'm like, you are Methuselah. I mean, you're like, he's like 100 times smarter than I am. And I mean, and it's like he's half dust at this point. You know, she's got this other uncle, though, who's just, you know, it's not like he's not an unintelligent man, but he's just, as he's grown older, he's gone a little dull around the edges. His brain's gone a little soft. Now, I'm not saying that learning another language would make him more like the first uncle and less like the second, like in and of itself. But this is what they call a checkable fact in journalism. It is a scientific fact. You learn a language, you learn another language, you learn a second or a third language. It's going to keep you smarter. It's going to keep you sharper. It's going to keep your brain working a lot longer. So and probably staying off the junk. You know, if you're one of these kids at one of these schools where they apparently just hand drugs out willy-nilly.
Stay away from the meow-meow.
That's what I'm saying. You learn another language, and it actually does, it literally creates whole new folds in your brain. It activates different sections of your mind that maybe you haven't used for a long time, or that, you know, they just have not been used for anything. They're just busy, just filled with packing peanuts or something. So you call a Castalia Language Center, or you contact them at PortlandSpanish.com. PortlandSpanish.com. Clara Grubble is the woman who runs that school. She's a native Spanish speaker from Argentina, and she operates Spanish language classes for adults. No more than 8 people to a class, which means that, you know, it's going to get closer to individualized attention, and they can find something that works with your schedule no matter what day of the week, no matter what time of day works for you. They can probably find something that matches your needs. Whether you're a beginning Spanish student, intermediate Spanish student, or you're speaking it for a long time, but you want to just get the, you know, sort of a refresher course, brush up on it, they can help you with all that. PortlandSpanish.com is the website. Castalia Language Center, a proud sponsor of the Rick Emerson Show and the Emerson News Network. Please tell them you heard it here, won't you please? This is one of our fine esteemed sponsors, so do tell them that this is where you learned about them. PortlandSpanish.com.
You're listening to The Rick Emerson Show. This is the Emerson News Network.
There we go. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. Top five still to come today as
yes.
Well. That was the thing that I failed to promote at the opening of the show. What is today's top five, Don Taylor? We'll get to that here in a bit.
In honor of Geektober, it is my top five scariest horror movie soundtracks.
So this is the soundtrack of the score.
The score
is the most gripping, the most unnerving.
In my opinion. For me personally, the top five scariest horror movie scores.
I gotta say, I'm looking at this here. Okay, I didn't realize he did that. I'm looking at this. Looking at the top five. Don't you wish you could see the top five right now? So we'll get to that here in just a bit. That is the top five horror movie scores of all time in the assessment of Don Taylor. Speaking of Don Taylor, let's pay another visit to the news desk right here.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
A memorial service for actor Tony Curtis was held yesterday in Las Vegas, Nevada.
He loved life.
Curtis died last week from cardiac arrest at 85. The star's daughter, Jamie Lee Curtis, spoke during the memorial.
Let me cue this up here. I was trying to out-clever myself there. I was trying to get the, which is always, that's always where your mistake
that
is.
That never works, baguette boy.
You would not believe, you probably would believe, actually, the number of texts I've got that are, like, solely about me jamming bread into my mouth. And not only not being able to actually, it's not even that I can't swallow or chew the bread correctly, it's that the actual act of putting the bread in my mouth was enough to vex me. Like, that in and of itself sort of interfered with my, with my synaptic functions. All right, so this is Jamie Lee Curtis. All right.
We're all evidence of him, and our spouses, and our significant others.
That's great audio.
The wall led by him.
Because Jamie Lee Curtis has apparently turned into one of the adults in a Peanuts cartoon.
Fantastic. Speaking to us from the bottom of a well, Jamie Lee Curtis.
We're all evidence of him, and our spouses, and our significant others. We walk the walk. Led by him.
This is somebody who inadvertently recorded her eulogy with like a cell phone in their pants that they leaned on at the wrong moment, and then they went home later. And honey, does this sound like Jamie Lee Curtis speaking at a funeral to you? All right.
Well, okay.
What's the other cut?
She joked about her likeness to her dad.
Okay.
And all of us have something of him. I, of course, got his desperate need for attention.
And his penis.
At this point, we are only hopeful that the regulators will give us some clarity about the expectations, and then we can plan on that basis.
I thought we should have one legitimate news cut there. All right, there's.
That's nice.
Here's the thing. Does she look much like Tony Curtis?
No, I don't think she really looks like either of her parents. Much.
I mean, that's the, because you look at Janet Leigh,
yeah,
her mom, and I don't think she looks like Janet Leigh either.
No.
I mean, she's an attractive woman, I suppose, but she doesn't look like either of her parents. I mean, whatever. I mean, maybe she's adopted or something. I don't think they've ever said that, and I'm presuming she's not. But it is odd that she just sort of she seems to be created like entirely out of recessive genes.
Well, then there's that lifelong persistent rumor that there's always been that she was, or at least I don't sure lifelong, but this persistent rumor that's gone on for years that she was born. Like a hermaphrodite.
See, I wasn't going to say that. I was going to eschew the mention of that. But I will. Here's the only reason why is because I think the first time I actually mentioned it on this show it was a long time ago. It was maybe in the late 90s, early 2000s, like that. But I was doing the show here, and I said blah 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 blah, and that urban legend about Jamie Lee Curtis, blah blah blah, you know, the hermaphrodite. And it, like immediately what happened is it's like every guy and their yokel brother called up. Saying that, no, I took a biology class, and the professor said that, and it's like everybody claimed to have been in the class where the professor, or they, like, knew a guy who was the professor's aide, and they were there when the professor said that Jamie Lee Curtis was a hermaphrodite. And it's urban legends are entertaining, and they're amusing, and they're fun.
Yeah.
That I don't disagree with. What I find, though, strangely, even though because I love the sort of viral spread of information, so that fascinates me. So then, paradoxically, it just pisses me off when someone, straight-facedly says, like, you know, that, like, well, no, I know a guy who was, and it's like,
yeah.
I just want to put out their eyes with a fork. I just want to say, no, you don't, and you didn't, and it didn't happen. Yeah.
Yeah, on the other hand, it is one of those things that, I mean, heck, you know, she was born in a time when, yes.
You didn't talk about hermaphrodites.
You didn't talk about it, and babies were routinely just, you know, assigned a surgery at birth if they were born with both organs, you know, and she has never actually denied it, and her children are adopted. It is possible it's actually true. And I would like to say, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with it if it is true. But at the same time, though, it's like, yeah, I think it's interesting that people say, I love it when people say they know for a fact.
Right.
It's like, really? Do you know her? do you know her mom?
I like the...
Did your mom show you the medical records?
It is interesting, though, how you just... And I know you didn't do this intentionally, but just for a moment, you became like Michelle Malkin on Fox News, where you go, well, she has never denied it. I mean, why won't she just deny that she's a hermaphrodite?
I know. And most likely, it's really she hasn't denied it because she's just felt like... Same reason that Richard Gere has never denied the hamster in his butt.
Yeah.
It's better to just go, you know something? That's so ridiculous. I'm not even going to talk about it. I'm not going to dignify it by even rebutting it.
As the late, great Sam Kinison once noted, he was talking about the hamster in your ass thing. And he said he's never been at a party where they couldn't find something else to snort or drink. He said, you know, like, you're never that low on drugs. Like, you'll drink furniture polish if you think it's going to give you a buzz. Like, at no point do you ever go, hey, doesn't your brother have a gerbil? I mean, so, you know, the weird thing about that whole Richard Gere gerbil thing, I mean, apart from the obvious, the strange thing about that is that I sometimes say before the internet, and when I say that, what I mean is usually before the internet was widespread. I mean, when like you knew like some guy who had it, or when you were just like, or when you had to have like a university account or whatever. But in sort of the pre-internet era, I'm fascinated by how like it's not impressive now when urban legend spread, because it's like you post it on Dig and like everybody sees it, or maybe no one sees it if it's on Dig these days. But if you put it on on the Drudge and everybody hears something.
Yeah.
Anyway, but what's funny about that whole urban legend is that it not only, I want to say it didn't, you know, it has stuck with Richard Gere, but it actually, and this is true, that legend, I'm not saying the legend is true, but the urban myth did in fact lead to the downfall of a guy's career. And I don't even know that I want to say his name, because then I'm just another guy linking him to this story. So I don't mean to be vague about it, but it's just like the guy's been tagged with this forever. There was it's not difficult to find this information out, but there was a TV newscaster in Philadelphia, and for whatever reason, like in wherever, whenever it was this happened, like maybe the mid '80s, late '80s, whenever this legend first came to the fore, it tagged itself to Richard Gere, but it also, for unknown reasons, affixed itself to this TV newscaster in Philadelphia, and actually. You can, I think it's at Snopes, where they actually talk about the spread of this urban legend, and they said it became so persistently repeated about this newscaster in Philadelphia that it is widely assumed that it is one of the reasons why he was eventually forced to leave the city, because he became sort of a punchline around the town. I know some guys who grew up in Philadelphia, and they know it's not true, but I know some guys who grew up in Philadelphia who said that everywhere you went in Philadelphia in the mid to late 80s, everybody you talked to, if this TV newscaster's name came up in Philadelphia, which is, you know, it's a large town, but I mean, you know, but it's also a town that's very fragmented, so everybody sort of knows everybody in your neighborhood. Everybody in town made the association between this TV anchor guy and the gerbil in the ass.
Wow.
And he was just like, yeah, he's like, you couldn't go anywhere in Philly without mentioning this anchor person's name. Somebody go, oh, yeah, the ass gerbiling guy. You know, and it's weird. And so if you go to Snopes and look it up, they'll give you the guy's name, and they will say that it was widely linked to a Philadelphia newscaster, and it was a specific guy. And it makes you wonder, like, how did that happen? Like, why him? You have all the newscasters in all the cities in all the world. Why would that guy get stuck with the gerbil in the ass story? And there's probably no way to figure it out.
I don't know. It's like there was the rumor for a long time about Rock Hudson and Jim Nabors being married, and that came basically a radio disc jockey, I think it was, made a joke. He lived up the street from Rock Hudson, and there were a bunch of people doing something. And I guess it was sort of widely known, not a very particularly well hidden secret, that Rock Hudson was gay.
Right.
And that Jim Nabors was gay. And they were both closeted. But the guy made some joke apparently on the radio that he, you know, that all these people clogging up his street on their way to Rock Hudson and Jim Nabors' wedding. And it just spread from there and became like this ridiculous urban legend that apparently, you know, they had actually gotten married.
I am just fascinated by that. I mean, I could just, that is the thing. If I were a college student or a professor or something, that would be the, you know, I'd be like one of those Jan Brunvard guys where I would just track urban folklore and try to, you know, to find the starting points for myths like that. Because you said it was probably just some jackass DJ who just had it as a joke, not in thinking that anybody would ever take
it
seriously.
Not a particularly funny joke.
Yeah.
A pretty offensive joke, really, when you think about it. But yeah. And
then it just gets repeated.
Yeah.
You know, to one guy, to two guys, to four, to eight, to 16, to whatever. So
there's a point where, people, just regular folks, well, you know.
Yeah. Well, and the thing about Jamie Lee Curtis is she does have sort of, she's tall and she has, I guess, what might be considered kind of masculine features in some way. But hey, let me ask you this about Jamie Lee Curtis. So I don't know why I'm asking you that. Dawn, you've got breasts.
Yes, I do. Thank you for noticing.
Here's the thing about Jamie Lee Curtis's breasts, which are an object of fascination for men of my age.
Okay.
She seems to have at one point gotten massive breast implants and then had them almost totally removed later on. Mm. Have you noticed that? I mean, I don't know if it's a thing you even track, if it's even on your radar.
No, I don't really pay a lot of attention to Jamie Lee Curtis' breasts.
I do, and I did in Trading Places specifically.
Mm-hmm. You actually got to see them in Trading Places, didn't you?
Yes, a whole generation got to see them. Yes. And it's like, but you look at her in like, The Fog and Halloween and whatever, and that's not, I mean, like that far apart gear-wise. But then you look at her after Trading Places, and it's like she's just back to being the way she looked before when she was Laurie Strode. So it was almost like she got them just for that movie. I mean, it was weird. It was almost like they were an accessory, like they came with her wardrobe or something. It's sort of strange.
I don't know. I mean, she got like super scary fit when she about that same period of time when she made that aerobics movie with John Travolta.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe she was taking a little bit of something to help her like bulk her muscles up. That might have done it.
What was it?
It could have also just been from like working out really heavily.
That wasn't Perfect 10, was it?
Perfect.
Perfect was the name of it.
Yeah.
Perfect 10 is a magazine. All right. Yeah. Perfect. I've forgotten all about that movie.
Yeah. So
wow.
It could have been from that.
All right. It's 503-505-6964. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Let's do a couple more, and then we'll do your top five. Well, actually, it will mix up the order a little bit.
Let's do the Taser Watch.
All right. Here is your Taser Watch for Tuesday right here in the Rick Emerson radio program. You got me running, going out of my mind. I can't do it, bro. You got me thinking that I'm wasting my time. Don't taste me, bro. Here is your Taser Watch for Tuesday.
A police sergeant named Phil Hurton in Massachusetts arrived at Metro West Medical Center for his work detail and rushed into an emergency room when he was asked to deal with an unruly person. There he found Kelly Hartzog, 33, sitting in a wheelchair screaming at EMTs and repeatedly kicking them. It is not known why she was at the hospital. After several minutes of trying to get Kelly Hartzog to calm down, Hurton told her he would use the taser on her if she did not stop struggling. That's when her sister, Brandy Hartzog, got into Hurton's face and said, "You better not tase my sister or there will be trouble." After Kelly Hartzog continued to struggle with the EMTs, kicking one in the stomach and scratching a second one, Hurton shocked her with his taser. After he pulled the trigger, he was hit hard in the back of the head and it knocked him to the side. When Hurton fell, the taser, which was still activated, touched an EMT's hand and shocked the EMT. Hurton arrested Brandy Hartzog and charged her with assault and battery on a police officer and disorderly conduct. So to recap, she hit the cop. The sister of the wheelchair girl hit the cop in the back of the head, knocked him down, which caused him to accidentally shock an EMT with his taser.
So that makes me wonder. So as this is sort of being described, I was wondering if you linked up, like if a bunch of people happened to touch each other, could you tase like 70 people at once? Would it transmit the electricity all the way through? So like if she bumped, because the way I thought it was going to go, I thought it was going to be that like the wheelchair girl, like somebody fell onto the wheelchair and it like tased three people at once or did something. I wonder if that would actually work that way.
No, I don't think so, because I think you end up being grounded.
Well, on the power.
What he did was his taser was still on.
Right,
and his finger was still on the trigger when he went down, and he bumped the
AT and it crossed, the wire, because it's not just the tips. It's like anywhere along the wires because they're exposed.
Actually, someone in the text box says, yes, you can do that.
Really?
Daniel Tosh did it on his TV show.
So I bet there would be a finite number of people because the energy probably dissipates as it goes through each person. So unless you had a constant power source, like if you're plugged into the wall or something, it probably diminishes with each subsequent tasing that's sort of being administered there. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Brandy Hartzog in her mugshot, which is available on our website.
You go to rickemerson.com/pictures, by the way.
Yeah, she looks positively happy to be arrested.
Looks radiant.
She looks radiant.
Hold on, let me see here. I've closed the website.
She also has dead shark eyes.
Let's see here. RickEmerson.com/pictures, and you go to the visual aids for today. That is October 5th, 2010. Let's see here. Hold on a second. Where the hell did I put them? Oh, she really does. She's got kind of a weird... You know what she looks like? She looks like... Okay, here's the thing. Follow me on this.
Okay.
Her eyes are strangely glittery, but dead. Like those, like a brightly polished doll's eyes or something. she looks like a... She looks like a weathered, black-haired version of Julie Benz from Dexter.
A little bit, yeah.
That's kind of what she's got going. Oh, did you ever watch Dexter, by the way?
No.
Okay, well, when we're done with this, I'll tell you my thoughts on it and whatever, so there you go. All right, there's your Taser Watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson radio program. You got me running, going out of my mind.
I can't do it, bro! You got me thinking that I'm wasting my time. Don't taste me, bro!
Fantastic.
Someone in the text box says that the passing it on from person to person, he said, it actually gets worse as you go through the line.
Really?
The last person gets the worst shock, and he says, speaking from retarded experience.
Awesome. I'm going to start using that phrase more often. it is the Rick Emerson radio program. Don't forget, our Geek-O-Lantern carving contest is now underway. All you have to do is take any vegetable of any kind. And I suppose we got to open up to just fruit as well. Just carve organic matter. It doesn't really matter. I mean, look, if we're going to say it's for geeks. And
it's something you can hollow out and turn into a lantern.
But then we're going to get somebody's head. That's the thing. You notice that there's going to be somebody's prosthetic limb that's been carved or whatever.
I would totally give the prize to someone who made a jack-o'-lantern out of a prosthetic limb.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, do we want to just expand it to like anything, you know, carving anything that was once alive? Because it seems like we are inviting trouble with that, but what do I know? So you just you carve a geek themed jack o' lantern into a pumpkin or what have you, and you send that to contest at rickemerson.com, and I'm going to put up a blog posting about that today, so you can see all the details on that. contest@rickemerson.com. Those will all be posted in an online gallery, and then we have the four prizes from ThinkGeek.com, as well as that $100 gift certificate. And those are going to be given away. I've got to receive those by the end of Monday, October 25th. So there you go. So just carve them into, like, you know, whatever you've got sitting around.
And something geeky. Remember, the theme is Geektober, and it's a geek-o-lantern, so you want to come up with something geeky.
Can I just tell you what I saw last year? Somebody had a Zoidberg. They had carved it. It was like a front view of Zoidberg, and he had, you know, so he has like the weird... Whatever those things are in his, you know,
yeah.
What are those?
I don't know what
I'm talking about, around his mouth, mm-hmm. The little, like, they're not tentacles, mm-hmm. Or are they? Because sometimes he'll do that Stooges, like, thing, and they sort of, they wave like palm fronds swaying in the wind.
I'm sure there's some scientific name for that I don't know what it is.
Hey, real quickly, speaking of a thing that I mentioned earlier, here's the, do you have your phone on you?
Yes.
You ought to call my, this is a build-up to a larger question. I have a question for you, but before I even, ask you the question, I will lead up to it with
You want me to call you and,
so you hear my new ringtone.
Oh, okay. Wow. This is.
No, it's going to be worth the payoff. I don't know if you've actually, some people, long-time listeners may have heard this before.
Sitting across the table from you and I'm calling you to play.
Here's the thing, before you even do it.
I
got to say, before you even call me, think about the technology. You're actually picking up that phone, you're dialing it, it's going to, I don't know, space or something, and then coming back down here so it can go into a microphone, which is going into a computer, which is going out over the internet to, like, New Jersey, so it can come back and be listened to by, the law of averages indicates, by some guy who's probably a block away from us.
And so we could play a song off your phone.
Just effed. So longtime listeners may have heard this before, but I don't know that you have, Dawn, and it's definitely right. Playing it. So here's my new ringtone, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, here we go. I'm dialing. And
isn't this exciting? Wait for it.
Rick! Hey, buddy, it's Sam Kinison. Pick up your phone, buddy. Pick up your phone! Oh! Oh! Somebody's calling you, Dick.
All right. I haven't heard that for the longest time. I stumbled across that in my big collection of stuff the other night. And so it was, and I thought I lost it. That was the thing. I thought that I had forever misplaced the Sam Kinison answering or the voicemail. So it's like I loaded that on. And then, like a moron, I just, Lara was gone. She was, and I couldn't find her phone. She hadn't, you know, sometimes she leaves it at home. So then I just went online and I was actually calling my own phone, like from an instant messaging program, just so I could hear my own, which it's like I could play on the computer. You know, unlike, you know, just,
yeah,
just like QuickTime or something. I could just hit play and just, but I wanted to actually hear it come out of the phone. So I spent about 14 minutes trying to find a way to call my own phone from the Intertron.
That's why Thomas Gillen thinks, like, so why couldn't he just play it himself?
Just now, you mean?
Yeah.
I hadn't really thought about that. Anyway, moving forward, look. Let's not have any more correcting today. It sickens me. But this is all a build-up to asking you if, because now that I've actually got some time to sort of customize my, because when I first got it, you know, I didn't even take it out of the box the first night because I didn't have any, you know, I wanted to get the invisible shield put on it, and I was, that was, it seemed like I had a lot of things going on that week. I can't remember what, but it seemed like that was the week we had the power outage and we had to come back that night and do the late night show and whatever. So I didn't really have a chance early on to sit and just obsess over my iPhone. Now that I've carved out a little bit of time for myself, I'm going to begin the next stage of the customization process, which is custom ringtones for everyone. Oh. So you have to be thinking about what you would like as your ringtone.
Okay, I will think about that.
Okay, just you just ponder that. You roll it around your head. You let me know when you've come up with something.
I will.
All right. It is the and your tone of voice, by the way, indicates that I can tell you don't really take as much joy in the selection of a ringtone as I do.
No, my tone of voice is that I'm taking this very seriously.
So it's the opposite. It's that you're going to devote a significant amount of processing time and power to it,
because I have to decide, you know, what I want you to think of when you hear that it's going to be me.
Well,
do I want to pick a song that will make you like happy? I'm calling that you'll like. Oh, I like this song, so I'm glad Dawn is calling. Do I want to pick a song that will just irritate the crap out of you, so
yes,
that basically
do that.
I can passively aggressively annoy you every time I call you?
Yeah, so you pick a song that fills me with furious rage.
Do I want something that I think represents me as a person? Hey, I mean, you know.
Do you still have that ring back tone on your phone?
Which one?
The, you know, if I call you and it, like, it plays, because you have the thing where, like, if I call you, it doesn't ring, it plays music, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Do you, so
I
you still,
it's still
use that?
There. Yeah.
Have you noticed that people tend to be irritated by those?
Yeah, I know.
I don't know why. I'm not, I don't understand. I think it's because you're being forced to listen to someone else's music taste, whether you want to or not. It's like being in a car and someone else having control of the radio. I think that now, it's just because of the march of science and technology and whatever, I think we are now so used to being able to customize everything up to and including like our own, you know, like with Pandora, you can customize your own music station or whatever. I think we have now come to a point where we expect to not only get whatever we want at any moment, day or night, but we, as an adjunct to getting whatever we want whenever we want it, we now expect to never again have to listen to something we don't want to listen to. We've entered an era where it's like, you get whatever you want anytime, and also you will never have to be exposed to anything you don't wish to hear.
Well, also, I don't know if it's the same now, but for a long time, when I first started doing that, like a couple of years ago, it confused people because they still weren't used to ringback tones.
They thought they'd
yet.
Gone crazy.
Well, you call somebody, and even though we already started getting used to people putting on, you know, customizing their ringtones, still, if you call someone, you still pretty much expect to hear that kind of ringing sound.
It's true.
To let you know that the call is going through. And so if you call someone and instead of getting that ring, that ringing song, you would get, like in my case, you know, Tony Bennett singing something, or, you know, some kind of scary, you know, soundtrack music from something. It's like they don't know what's happened. They don't know if the call has gone through. They don't know if they're on hold. They don't know if they've gotten a message, a voicemail thing. You know, they don't know what's happening. So yeah. I think that's why people find them irritating.
And see, now I'm immediately wondering if, like, with our phone system here, if I can actually just put a custom ringtone on our phone here at the show. I don't even know why I would need to do that, but now that the thought has occurred to me, it seems like a thing I must do.
Someone in the text box suggests that for my ringtone, you need to get Yakety Sax.
No, I don't think I'm going to do that. All right. You're listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. Don't forget to join us tomorrow when we will be joined by either, and I'm uncertain about whether it's Kelly Clark or Aaron Mesh.
It's Kelly Clark.
Kelly Clark. So Kelly Clark from Willamette Week will join us in the program tomorrow. Thursday, Thursday, as our LDS friends say, Thursday is a special day. It is the we're going to have Mr. Bill Carter, who's the author of Fools Rush In, the guy behind the film Miss Sarajevo.
And he's dreamy.
Yeah, have I mentioned the thing on the air? You know what I'm talking about. My wife's...
I think you did.
I can't remember if I mentioned it on the air or if I just mentioned it to you and Sarah and Greg when we were off the air that time.
I'm pretty sure you mentioned it on the air.
See, now it's like I don't even know if I want to say it, because if I haven't mentioned it on the air, is it going to make it all awkward for tomorrow?
I think you did, but...
All right, well, if I haven't mentioned this, I'll say it real quick. My wife is putting together this whole book of this authors I'd like to F book club. I think I have mentioned that, actually. But the thing is, she's stuck at 2.5 authors. The first is Bill Carter, because he's awesome. And he is, don't get me wrong. If he offered to have relations with me, I might do it. The second is Jonathan Krakauer, the author of Where Men Win Glory and Into the Wild and Into Thin Air. And he's like a mountaineer, you know, but he's a hippie, but he's smart, but he's rich, but he, you know, loves the outdoors and whatever. And the half is Chuck Palahniuk.
So she would... Now, is that like she only half wants to, would only halfway do something, or she knows that...
It's that he's the gay.
Yeah.
So it's really not...
So she'd like to, but she knows it wouldn't happen.
Yeah, it's like she didn't want to get her hopes up, you know.
Because she's got a shot with the other two.
Well, I'm just saying. I mean, they're all on the same side of the fence, at least. Mm. You know, Chuck Palahniuk, I thought it was because he just has zero body fat, because he's just... It's like that guy turns sideways, and he just vanishes on you. But
maybe it might be because... and I say this as someone who actually has met the man and interviewed him and have enjoyed some of his books a great deal. He's a little creepy.
He's
really cool, and I admire him, and I think he's immensely talented. And yeah, he's actually very good looking, but he's also one of those guys that the things he writes about, he gives off a little bit of that vibe when you meet him, too.
There's a little... I've only interviewed him once, I think. We had him in the studio maybe last year, 2 years ago. It was when... what was the one about the gangbang? Snuff?
Yeah.
It's when Snuff came out. And we had him in the studio for that, and he was... there's a little something going on underneath the surface there. There's something unpleasant boiling underneath the skin of that cauldron. Anyway, I mean, you know, he seemed like a nice guy. But he seemed like a guy that he seems like the guy who writes the kind of stuff that he writes about.
Yeah.
You know, and that is often the case. I mean, a lot of authors are just freaking weird, and they're just this is strange. Like in my experience, like a far greater, like a much bigger proportion of authors are creepy than like actors or singers. I mean, musicians are crazy. They're all kind of nuts in some weird way, but they're not creepy. The creepiness seems to be disproportionately present in the authorial community than any other form of art. Sometimes it manifests itself to different degrees. Like Stephen King, on the one hand, like Stephen King is sort of, he's actually not creepy because he's just, like, he's so sort of charming and good-natured about being into really creepy stuff.
Yeah.
He has a lot of creepy interest. He himself seems like a very mild-mannered, pleasant guy. It's just that he's kind of got that every now and again, the sort of gleaming eye and the arched eyebrow of, you know, that he wants to shove your hand into a pile of maggots or something. But he can play creepy really, really well, as he demonstrated a couple weeks back on Sons of Anarchy, which airs tonight,
by the way. And he knows he's just
weird-looking,
too.
That's the thing.
He knows that.
And he embraces, like, the fact that he's just like a big bumpkin who's like 100 feet tall. God, I was watching. Lara had never seen Creepshow. I had failed as a man, and she had never seen Creepshow. So we watched Creepshow like a month ago, and of course he's in that as a Jody Verrill, the bumpkin, and it was just awesome. And then 2 nights ago he was a cleaner, he was a sort of Mr. Wolf on Sons of Anarchy, where when you have a body and you need to not have a body, he's the guy who comes and takes care of that.
He's the stew maker.
Yes. I don't want to spoil anything.
I'm going to have to spend like a whole weekend or something just powering through to catch up, aren't I?
Yeah, this isn't a spoiler because I've already kind of told you he's a disposal agent.
Yeah.
But it's just a little cameo where they need to call a cleaner. And again, this isn't like a huge plot point or anything, but they need to call a cleaner. And so they're like, I called the cleaner. He'll be here in a few minutes. And then there's a knock at the door and they open it up. And it's just Stephen King standing there, which is just awesome. And it's like, on the one hand, it takes you out of the show because you go, it's Stephen King. But then it's like, he's creepy. And so you immediately buy into it. And he said, you know, I'm the cleaner or whatever. You know, he's like, you called for Bob. And so they take him down to the basement where there's this body they need to get rid of. And it's like, and it's not, I mean, and it's just a regular house. So it's not like they're in the country. There's no swamp out back. It's just a regular, like, suburban basement. And he goes into the basement. Time passes. Basement door. He comes back out of the basement just wearing his leather jacket. And, you know, and he's like, okay, that'll be, you know, $40,000 or whatever it is he charges. and they said, okay, well, is it, I mean, where's... You know, because he'd ask for like some solvents and like drain cleaner or whatever. And they said, well, where's the rest of her? And he just, you know, he just looked and he just gives him that dead fish eye and just says, who? You know, and clearly, like, the creepy thing was that, like, even her bones had somehow been disposed of down in the basement. And he didn't really tell and they didn't really ask. And it's just great. It's just one of the best cameos ever.
How freaked out would you be if, for any reason, there was a knock at the door and you opened it up and Stephen King was standing there?
I think I might wet my pants and then die.
I would just shriek.
Yeah.
Like someone had set me on fire.
Yeah.
Or either that or I would be just so dumbfounded I would just stand there looking at him like, okay, no, this makes no sense.
See, it's like I'm trying to imagine I'm trying to play that scenario out of my head right now, and it's like I get sort of brain wobbles. Like, yeah. I can't really, like, the picture goes a little loopy. I can't really imagine that happening.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that you just know that the thing he gets, you know, he lives in his little main town, so he sees the same people all the time, but that whenever he goes places, like, I guess many years ago, I had a friend who worked at a bookstore, and she had Stephen King was doing something. He was doing a signing or some kind of an event, and he had come into the bookstore, which was, like, you know, down the street, and just shopped and bought something, and nobody really paid any attention to him. And he wrote a check,
right?
And he handed over the check, and the woman was ringing it up, and she looked at the check and saw it said Stephen King on it, and she looked up at him and realized he was Stephen King. And apparently, she just stood there and just looked at him and looked down at the check and looked at him. And looked down at the check and looked at, and then he just gave her this big scary smile, and she just rang him up and said, "Here's your books."
Awesome.
And she couldn't even, like, say anything because it was just like,
Well, and I love the idea that he knew that the best reaction was just to grin at her like a maniac, because here's now we're just off into a whole thing, but that's fine. You know, Greg and Sarah have already taped today.
Right, we can go along.
And, you know, the thing is, and I'm basically not allowed to go home right now. Because my wife is working, Lara's working 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. right now, these 12-hour overnight shifts. So I'm not allowed to do two things, complain about my job and come home because she's trying to sleep right now. And so it's the thing where I can't go home until like 6. So I got to basically just occupy myself till then.
I have a movie to go to tonight, but no, I don't. No, that's tomorrow night. No, I could be here so till midnight if I wanted to.
But the but just as an adjunct to this, the thing about Stephen King, and I'm a big Stephen King fan, and I read this something that I found it for a quarter at a yard sale about a month ago. It was called The Stephen King Companion, and I'd never seen it before, but it was just a collection of essays and interviews that he'd done, and then a book by book analysis by various other authors. And Harlan Ellison contributed to it and has a lot of really great essays about different facets of Stephen King's career and the difficulty in transitioning to films for Stephen King's properties and why all of his movies suck and, you know, and his place in the history of American folk tradition and whatever. But they note in the Playboy interview that he did, which is like one of the best interviews he's ever done, that the great thing about Stephen King's books is that even though you can lose yourself in the book and suspend disbelief and whatever, you are always sort of vaguely aware of the presence of Stephen King in his books. And in a way that I have, and I've thought about this many, many times, that when you read a Stephen King book, you always get the sense, especially when something particularly vile or horrific or terrifying or just effed is about to happen or is happening, I always picture Stephen King doing exactly the same thing right at the moment of the book where I say, like, oh, hell no, you know, and it's like he plunges me into some horrific, awful scenario that I have never in my wildest imaginings, you know, ever dreamt of. Like that awful thing he wrote where the guy crashes on a desert island and ends up eating himself to live.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, first I cut off my earlobes. And I remember reading that and going, like, why would you ever think of that?
Or the guy who grows the eyeballs all over himself.
Yeah, in a Night Shift.
Yeah, and he tries to get rid of one by putting a cigarette out in it.
Yeah.
And,
and it's like, and I remember, you know, reading Night Shift specifically, which is just full. That way, Night Shift is also the book that contains, that contains just a whole number of bad stories. Like the, and I mean, great, but I mean, just wrong. Like The Ledge, where he makes the guy walk around the ledge of the like penthouse apartment high rise, you know, on a bed or whatever. And I remember reading that and just thinking, what kind of man writes these stories? And as I get to that moment, what I always picture is Stephen King at an Underwood typewriter leaning back for a moment and rubbing his hands together in glee and cackling.
Apparently that's not far off, because I've read interviews with him and stuff in the past where he talked about, I mean, this was back, you know, at the height of his writing, which of course means he was also like
coked out of his mind.
He was coked out of his mind. But that, yeah, he would just blast heavy metal music and write, and that when he got to particularly horrific scenes, he said he would just start giggling.
Yeah.
So, by sheer coincidence, you had no idea of this while we started talking about this. I actually just picked up Salem's Lot last night and started rereading it.
Really? I haven't read Salem's Lot for years, probably since high school.
I haven't either. And about a year or so ago, I got a hardcover copy of it that's illustrated. It's got some illustrations in it, and it has a new introduction that he wrote. And it's just been sitting on the shelf for a really long time. And I picked it up and I started reading it. And when I started reading it, that's when you have that moment when you start rereading a book and then you realize how long it's been since you read something that it's all new again. And I was like, ooh, this is like reading a brand new book because it's been so long since I read this.
Part of me doesn't like to reread books at this point in my life because, A, there's so many books I still have to read that I haven't read at all. And then also, I live in fear sometimes if I'm rereading books that I'm just becoming that guy. I don't mean to pick on him because I understand why he said this, but David Walker one time on the show, he actually said, Walker said this thing, where he said he realized he got into a certain point in his life when he turned however old, 35 or whatever. He turns X years old, and he said, he goes, and you know, and I looked at my record collection, and I thought, I'm set. I'm good. You know? And he just decided he didn't really care if he heard anything new. And it's like, and you know, I'm not knocking that, because just the law of averages, it dictates that almost everything good came out before. Just because there's always more in the past than there is, like, right now. So the math of it indicates that good things are almost always stuff from back then. That's just the way that the numbers work. But, you know, you don't want to be that guy with everything. And part of me feels like, well, if I just reread The Stand, am I just becoming like that guy? But I am going to go back and reread some of the better Stephen King books, some of my favorites. And I haven't read Salem's Lot forever. I mean, that was like he actually wrote that before Carrie was even published. That's the great thing about that is he sold Carrie. But it took 3 years between sale and publication for it to come out. And in the intervening time, he wrote Salem's Lot. So that is – Salem's Lot is great because here's the thing about Salem's Lot. That is the last Stephen King book written before he became a brand name. Carrie really was the one, you know, written before anybody even knew who he was.
Yeah.
But Salem's Lot was the last book written before he – became aware of what a market there was for his writing. So in a way, it's almost the last pure Stephen King book. Actually, you have to let me know if it holds up.
So far, yeah. There's so much I'd forgotten about it, because the thing is, you read a book like that, and then, of course, you've seen the movie,
right,
the miniseries and stuff based on it. And I'd completely forgotten that the entire beginning of Salem's Lot is takes place basically after all of the events of the book. It starts with the man is in this tiny little town, and he's traveling around with this boy, and everyone assumes the boy is the man's son. And everywhere he goes, he picks up a newspaper from Maine to look at what's happening in this little town called Jerusalem's Lot. And it's like, yeah.
That's creepy.
And they have nightmares, and we don't know why.
The final thought here is that, you know, there's a huge – and the thing about Stephen King is his fans are just – you know, he sells so many books to so many people that they just whore it in every way possible. So they do these collector's editions and hardcovers and illustrated and whatever. And a lot of them are really, really great. The whole thing that I'm on the trail of right now, and they're just so hard to find, and they're so expensive. I'm trying to find a copy of yet again, a thing that, like, if I'd had any brains when I was a kid, I'd still have it now. I'm trying to find a copy of the original Creepshow comic book.
Yeah.
Which goes for, like, $300 now.
Does it really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So if you got one of those, you hold on to it. Now, there are some reprints that came out a few years later that are not worth a whole lot.
I think that's what I have. I think I have the
if you have the actual
the reprint.
If you have the actual Creepshow comic that Romero and King put out, that's worth $200, $300.
Jesus.
So I'd be – well, it's like when I discovered I have this copy of the novel Fast Times at Ridgemont High. at home that Cameron Crowe wrote before the movie ever came out. You know, he went to school undercover, wrote the novel, and the movie came out. And it's like, I was just reading online, and I bought it for like 50 cents at like, again, like a garage sale. And I'm reading some interview with him, and they're like, hey, are you ever going to, you know, are they ever going to reprint Fast Times at Ridgemont High? And he said, no, you know, he goes, I kind of like it being out of print. It makes it sort of a collectible and kind of romantic, and, you know. He said, it's also a collector's item. And I thought, well, that's odd. And I went online, and I went to eBay, of course. You know, just immediately, you're just like, well, I wonder what eBay has to say about this. And I went, it was like the first person I saw was selling $450. And I just, are you effing with me? And so what did I immediately do? Ran downstairs, and I have no intention of selling it, but I had to make sure that I still had it. And then I'm looking at every imperfection and flaw, you know, like there's a water stain on the back. And it's like I paid 50 cents for it and didn't care about it until that moment. So anyway, you have to let me know if that holds up, if Salem's Lot holds up.
So remember how you got a message earlier from someone saying that they wanted a pee break?
Yes.
This might be a good time for you to do the cleaning solution spot.
Hey, so it might be. In fact, we'll start this, and then we'll come back on the other side of this. Well done. Well noted with the pee break. Wait, well, are you saying that you needed a pee break?
Yes.
Well, you got to wait and hear this story first, and then you can leave.
All right.
It says, Rick, I wanted to thank you for something. You played that Blood Rock song for my wife and I while we were mid-flight. Well, let's be clear. It's not like the show was piped onto an airplane. I mean, in the future, it will be. But I had played it for this guy and his wife because they were going to be flying. And so they were listening to the podcast, and like mid-flight, they reached the point where I'm playing Blood Rock. And he says, thanks. If it wasn't for the worst turbulence I had ever had, it would be funny. But as the song played, we were being tossed around like a Cobb salad. The masks came down, people freaking out. And here we are on the plane listening to the Rick Emerson Show, thinking we're going to plummet down to the sounds of Blood Rock. Really, if you got to go in a plane wreck, that's the way you want to go, is with this show playing Blood Rock in the background and us cackling. I say we're back and thankful that the show keeps getting new sponsors. Let's see. He says, I swear to God, I am not making this up. I didn't even know he said this when I started reading it. He says, we're back and thankful the Rick Emerson Show is getting new sponsors. We are a clean folk, but I'm thinking about soiling the carpet. And then he puts in parentheses, not with poo, so we can get our carpet cleaned by the carpet by the cleaning solution. Now, I'm
glad he cleared that up.
I swear to you, I did not know when I started. All I saw was the Blood Rock thing. I did not know that he referenced the cleaning solution in this when I started reading. I swear to you, I had no. All I saw was the Blood Rock thing. But just now, I found that out the same time you all did.
It's like you bringing up Stephen King, and I just started rereading Stephen King. You are prescient.
It's like
right
I was
now.
Meant to do this spot. Well, you were meant to prompt me to read this spot right
there
now.
There we go.
So there you go. So attention, advertisers. He's actually thinking about defiling his carpet, not with poo, so that he can contact the cleaning solution. The cleaning solution, that's Mr. Michael Beatty. It's 971-533-3211. 971-533-3211. That's how you contact him. He was the very first advertiser we had on the Rick Emerson Show on the Emerson News Network. And it's a fine Portland-based company, and they will clean anything your feet might touch, anything that might be, you know, you track in things from the outdoors, if you're working in the garden, or if it's, you know, wintertime, you're trudging in snow and sleet and ice and whatever. And it's just things getting ground into the carpet. And it's not a thing. It's not like, you know, you stain it right away. I mean, sometimes you do and you notice that, but sometimes you don't. It's not like an obvious spill or where the dog has an accident or something. You know, sometimes, you know, one day the carpet looks clean. A couple months later, carpet doesn't look so clean, even if you're vacuuming it. Even if you're, you know, you get one of those steam cleaning things from the supermarket. There's only so much you can do. So you contact Michael Beatty. He'll make sure that carpet is looking good, keeps looking good. Also, tile, your walkway, flagstones, your entryway. Anything like that, anything that your feet might touch and eventually, dirty up. You can contact him at 971-533-3211, 971-533-3211. And he's a Portland-based company. He tries to get his supplies, his accessories, all of that stuff from right here in Portland. And, of course, he keeps his advertising dollars here in Portland as well. 971-533-3211, 971-533-3211. That is how you contact Mr. Michael Beatty, proprietor of the cleaning solution. That was the fastest pee break I've ever seen. Did you? I don't mean to be
I can
crude
pee really
here,
quick.
But did you really go in and you did the whole front, you know, the A to Z, the entire process?
Yeah.
You're done?
I didn't wash my hands.
Okay, well, I think bit less of you now, but that's okay. I am legitimately impressed that you got it done like that. Well done.
I've gotten it down to a science.
Is it a thing that you have you practiced that? I mean, is it a thing you've sort of like have you worked at being able to do that so quickly?
Yes, and I did have a boyfriend once who commented on it that I leave the room and come back early. Because it's all a matter of things like. You start unrolling the toilet paper while
you're multitasking.
It's easier, I think, if you're female because your hands are free, so you can unroll toilet paper while you're urinating, and then that portion is ready when you need it.
So you're not busy. Inadvertently snapping an iPhone photo of your penis.
That too.
That's
yes.
What you're trying to say there. All right. So the Rick Emerson Show continues here in just a few moments. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Show right here on the Emerson News Network. You stay right there.
You're listening to The Rick Emerson Show. This is the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson radio program. That was Social Distortion. That is for your compatriot, Robert Bobby Bob. Not Fat Boy, but this is the guy that I met at your birthday party.
Yes.
And three different people introduced him to me with three different names. First it was Bob, then it was Bobby, then it was Robert, and then somebody else called him some other name.
Yeah, when I first met him, it was, well, I was working for him. He was the my editor at DVD Journal. And I first met him as Bobby because he's friends. He went to college with Mike Russell from The Oregonian, who's a film critic. And Mike called him Bobby. And then, so I always called him Bobby. And it only turned, or no, actually, I always called him Bob. And then it turned out, I found out later that no one calls him Bob except for Mike Russell. That everyone, his work friends, but everyone he knows from work calls him Robert. And then there are people in his private life who call him Bobby. And so it was like, apparently Mike Russell and I were the only ones who called him Bob. So, I don't know. Yeah, so he goes apparently by any of those.
Well, that guy.
I
met him at your birthday party, and he actually said, and this is one of those things that is sort of, it's great. It's great and it's flattering, and then it's weird, and then I feel all this pressure at the same time, where he said that his life, first of all, I'm just talking about how awesome we are, but he's a listener, and he mentioned, you know, many of our clients and business partners, kind of, you know, by name, which is without a list in front of them. He said that cleaning solution and that Castalia Language Center, and, you know, and he said actually his last six iTunes purchases had been based on things he'd heard us play that he really, really liked, which is sort of great because, again, you know, he's the one who referenced the David Walker quote, actually. I got some music. I'm sad. I'm good. I don't need new music. And he said that he had the same thing. Like, he didn't want to, like, sort of, you know, be like that. But he appreciated the sort of alternative country stuff that we played sometimes. So that was Bobby, that one's going out to you. That was Social Distortion. So that is the title cut from their 1986, I think, album Prison Bound. So that's quite a fine song is what that is.
I love them. I love them very much.
Freaking awesome. Just to touch back on something that we mentioned last hour in Legion of News, we were talking about antiquing and the town of Silverton, where Howard Hessman is from. And we were talking about these little small towns where the entire industry is based on antiquing. I have to just tell you, for the love of God, I can't find it anywhere. But I have a CD that is, you know, it's like some MP3 files, but it's a CD I have at home somewhere from a little private performance that Mike Ness did in Portland about 3 years ago. It's when Sarah was working. It was when Sarah was doing the morning show on KNRK, which she did for a while. And so there was this period of time a few years ago where Sarah was doing the mornings with Greg on KNRK. And as part of that, you know, you get to kind of meet guys and do performances and whatever. And so she Social Distortion was coming to town, and they gave away this little prize where it was at a recording studio. It was at the Kung Fu Bakery, I think it's called, but it's actually a studio, and it's on Division somewhere. And anyway, but you got like 10 listeners got to go and see Mike Ness and like one of the other guys from Social Distortion just do a little private performance of like five songs. And it was in a room, wow, seriously, like no bigger than the studio. And we sat on the floor. And I, you know, so she brought me along, and she's like, Rick, would you like to go see Mike Ness? And, yes. And so we sat in a room like this. We all sat on the floor. They sat on like some bar stools, and then a guy like hooked up a microphone and recorded it and whatever. But it was like the most low-tech setting imaginable. I mean, it wasn't like, I mean, we were literally just like cross-legged on the ground while Mike, it was like a campfire where he just like strummed songs to us from a distance of like 3 feet away. But I don't have the recording of it anymore. She has a copy, so I got to conjure it up in some way. Because he told, like, these kind of cool stories, and, you know, and then and so this song's called Ball and Chain. And I'm just, you know, and I'm just, like, sitting there nerding out. Literally rehearsing outside with Sarah what I will say to Mike Ness when I meet him, which I carried off flawlessly, by the way. But then, so we're wrapping up, and all the listeners have left. And it's Sarah and, I think, Gustav was the other guy. He was, like, Gustav and, you know, looking sort of Teutonic and terrifying as he always does. It was Gustav and Sarah and myself and, you know, Mike Ness from Social Distortion. And we're just standing around, and I think Sarah and I had driven there together, so we were waiting to leave. And Sarah's a very stylish, attractive woman. And so Mike Ness said, so what do you have any, you know, the show's not for a few hours. Do you have any plans? And I thought, aha, he's asking her out for coffee. And we know what that means. You know, it was like I sort of thought he was kind of putting the moves on her, you know, which is, I guess, awesome. And And she said, well, you know, I got to do some production at the station, but I, you know, I have some time. What do you have in mind? He's like, I don't know. I really wanted to do some antiquing. and I hear that Southeast Portland's great for antiquing. I'm looking for a specific kind of lamp. And it was like the weirdest. And it became clear that it wasn't code for like, let's go, you know, do something, you know, let's go do something rockin' and, you know, and scandalous. It was like he really wanted to go antiquing.
Oh, that's great.
And I'm unclear about whether, I think she actually kind of bailed out. I think she passed it off to a friend of hers who was there and who kind of knew the ins and outs of antiquing. She's like, so-and-so, would you like to take Mike Ness antiquing? And I asked her later, I'm like, why would you? And she said that she was afraid that the longer she was in his presence, the greater the odds she would do something dumb and embarrass herself. So she's like, you know what? It ended on a high note. I was going to pull the ripcord then. But that was his whole thing, is like before he went to rock, he wanted to go antiquing. It was just sort of great. I mean, it's just weird, though. All right. Well, in any event, before we roll the news in the top five, we have the top five scariest scores from a horror film in the assessment of Don Taylor. So we'll get to those here in just a second. Before we get to that, I mentioned early in the program this John Lennon thing, because it was his, 70th birthday today? Or is his 70th birthday if he were still alive?
I think it's today, yeah. Today, so it's, or next week or something.
If it's today, then I may in fact play this piece of audio that I, for obvious reasons, we have never been able to play in the show in the past because it's relentlessly profane, but it is genius. It is a piece of audio about and in the style of John Lennon, and it is called The Magical Misery Tour. And
actually, his birthday is October 9th, so I believe that's Saturday.
All right. Well, so I may or may not get to it today. I'll try to. But the thing is, it's relentlessly profane, which is the only way you can play it. An edited version of it would not work. And so I've been thinking about how to do that. And I think that what we'll do, and we might handle anything in the future that we know we want to play for whatever reason, but that, you know, but that has some sort of objectionable language. And as I mentioned to you during the break, the only reason I even really care about that stuff, for the most part, is that we do have a lot of people who listen to this at work. We've had a lot of people say that they have it playing, you know, at their desk or in their cubicle in their office. And I want to get it. And we have – this show has unfortunately gotten people fired in the past.
We can play it Friday, and we can warn people ahead of time that it's coming up on Friday.
I think what we'll do is, whether it's today or whether it's Friday, we'll play it live, and we'll give people sufficient warning. And then I think what we might do when we post it online is I'll post it in exactly the same section and just make it a separate file. Somebody asked me if we were ever to have like two versions of the show, like one that was bleeped and one that wasn't, or whatever, you know. And that just seems like a lot of work. So that's like intern time, like when we have an intern do that. So we'll get to that either today or tomorrow. Tomorrow on the Rick Emerson Show, Kelly Clark from Willamette Week will be here. Thursday, author Bill Carter and listener Jenny will be in the studio. Our good friend Jenny Hieronymus will be here, and she'll be doing the, I swear to God, it's called this, the top five Pearl Jam songs you're a dick if you don't like. That's what I told her she could call it whatever she wanted, and that's what it is. Because I think this Thursday, or this week, is the 20th anniversary of their first performance together, which means we're all goddamn old, by the way.
Yeah.
So it is the top.
But they are, too.
I suppose. Although Eddie Vedder still looks, I mean, he always kind of looked a little old. He had a little bit of that baby fat going on.
He's just adorable.
Yeah, he really is.
With scary, sexy eyes.
He does have this sort of, you know, not of this world vibe going on.
Yeah.
So that's this Thursday. We'll do the top five Pearl Jam songs you're a dick for not liking, if that is in fact the case. That's with listener Jenny. All right, let's pay a visit to the news desk with Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Parts of Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas are getting a reminder that summer is long gone. National Weather Service meteorologist Lynn Burse says nighttime temperatures nearing record lows will be settling in for a few days.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's weather?
You. Yes.
All right. Hold on a second. Let me scale this down here. As much as we often say that the weather isn't a story, apparently the weather is, in fact, a story sometimes. This cut is just called weather.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more rare for us to stay cool.
Nah, hold on a second. I'm sorry. I'm getting the wrong one. Ah, for the love of God. Wait.
Settling in for a...
Wait, there we go.
Looking for lows Monday morning by sunrise to drop into the upper 30s to lower 40s range.
All right. I had three different cuts called Weather, and they were all out of order, so I was trying to find the right one. And I'm not even really sure if that is the right one. That's Weather 1.
Yeah, this might be, because she also said, she said nighttime temperatures nearing record lows have arrived, but won't be staying around for long.
It's probably more rare for us to stay cool than it is for us to get cool.
All right, that was really not worth the effort.
That was like the worst story ever.
Especially in September, Don. That was not worth the effort I put into it.
I hate that story.
I'm sorry. You know what I did save, though, is I saved the soundbite of the woman saying it doesn't usually get this hot, especially in September. And I'm going to play that at Slack moments just to amuse you.
If that story was a person, I would punch it in the face.
Okay.
That's how much I hate that story.
Just give it a good raping. All right, here's Don Taylor.
Less than a week after a publishing snafu resulted in thousands of copies of Freedom being pulped in the UK, author Jonathan Franzen ran into trouble again at his London book party last night. While Franzen was busy celebrating the error-free debut of his book, the earlier version was scrapped.
Thousands of copies of Freedom being destroyed.
There were typesetting errors.
Oh, his novel, Freedom.
Yes, his novel.
All right, okay. Is that his newest one?
Yes.
Okay, so this is typesetting errors. So it wasn't like he'd written something inadvertently libelous or something.
No. It was just there were thousands of copies were printed, and then they discovered there were numerous typesetting errors.
All right, okay.
So they had to actually pull them from the stores, destroy them.
All right.
And so now they've, releasing. Now the Not this one isn't screwed up debut of
right.
his novel coming out. So they had a party. A party crasher stole the glasses off of the author's face and left behind a ransom note demanding $100,000 for their return.
That's bizarre.
A police helicopter was dispatched to search for the two thieves. And because it was a book party, the hashtag GlassesGate soon materialized on Twitter. The saga ended when a HarperCollins sales manager found one of the robbers hiding in the bushes, and Franzen decided not to press charges.
Well, because that's almost certainly a crazy person. You know? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. That's a thing that only makes sense inside the cubist version of that guy's thought process. I have a question for you. Okay, I don't mean to sound dumb, but I've learned that is an unavoidable consequence of being dumb.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to embrace it, and I'm going to be zen with it. I'm going to roll.
I'll try not to mock you for your stupidity.
Well, here's the thing. You and I have talked about technology sometimes and how it marches on so quickly these days. And we have made the fun of Sarah for not understanding how to do certain like putting electrical tape over the webcam on her Mac because she's afraid that it just like magically turns on and spies on her sometimes.
Yes.
She's kind of the gold standard for this because she's like 50 now and she's still and she still has like a cassette deck in her car. She prefers cassettes to CDs and MP3s. She's like, I don't really understand MP3s. A cassette, I understand. I mean, it's just sort of great. And she's got like purple hair and was wearing a Gem T-shirt, and yet she's still just like, I mean, she just sounds like she's about 100. She said that she doesn't understand Twitter. She said that many, many, many times.
Yeah.
She's like, I don't get Twitter, so I don't ever use it. I kind of get Twitter, but not really. I mean, I know how to send messages. That's about it. I don't understand what the hashtag thing is. What does that do? Does it do anything? Or is it just like one of those wacky memes like on FARC where everybody was doing two slashes and then like a fake HTML line?
Basically, it sorts messages into categories.
It does actually do something, though.
Right.
It's functional.
You create a hashtag, and then if you click on that hashtag, it will take you to all of the messages that have that hashtag attached to it. So you can therefore...
Can anybody create a hashtag?
Yeah.
So I could create like a Rick Emerson one?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
You type hash,
I know,
hash mark.
No,
thing.
I mean, I know what that is, but how do you, is that the, okay, I'm sorry,
that's
go ahead.
It.
But
you,
that's the
you
actual.
Type, you type whatever it is you want the hashtag to be with a hash mark in front of it.
And if it doesn't exist, that creates it?
Yeah.
The category, like a grouping?
Yeah. So if you were the only one who did that, if you click on it, you'll only see that one message. But if like hundreds of people post different messages with that particular hashtag in it, then if you click on the hashtag, then you'll see all of those messages.
That's weird. I suppose it's probably considered bad form just to have like your own name or, something. I just don't know how that works because I've seen it sometimes. But here's the thing is like most of the time now when I see the hashtag thing, it's like It is, and it, by the way, feel free to like message or email me or whatever if you feel I need some further explanation on this, because I understand this is one of those discussions that everybody who doesn't use Twitter doesn't care, and the people who do use Twitter already know, so I'm basically just talking to you. But most of the hashtagging that I've seen done now on Twitter is done as like a gag, where it's like some clearly like it's some like overly wordy hashtag that is obviously just meant to be like a goof.
Yeah, or it's just it's ironic, or it's done as kind of a punchline to your Twitter.
When that's the thing they've been doing on FARC for the longest time with backslashes, where it's almost like a closing HTML tag joke. So God, we're nerds. But can I just tell you how long I spent? I spent like 25 minutes on the net, I don't know, a few months back, trying to figure out how I could actually type something as HTML without the HTML without the actual formatting disappearing. In other words, I wanted to put something inside the greater than, less than marks and keep those visible, because I was doing like – I did it like – I bracketed a post with geek, and then at the end it was like – /geek. But then when you type that, the formatting disappears, though. And so I had to actually go online and find the HTML code to put around that so that the actual fake HTML would continue to appear.
Which, by the way, that was one of the few things I had a quibble with in the movie The Social Network, because there's a scene where you see Zuckerberg writing on a LiveJournal.
Right.
And I used to use LiveJournal.
I was
on LiveJournal. I had a blog on LiveJournal for about 6 years, and it's a WYSIWYG text editor.
What does that mean, Don?
What you see is what you get, and you can write things in code for LiveJournal, but it was obvious on screen from the screen he had up when he was typing that he was using the WYSIWYG interface.
Right.
And at the end of one of his things, he types the HTML code,
or something.
Yeah, for closed paragraph, which you don't have to
it's
do.
It's one or the other. Yeah.
Yeah, if you're using, you know, a WYSIWYG.
I love WYSIWYG. It's just that, you know, nothing makes it, and both, I love the actual acronym, and I also love it in point of fact. Nothing makes me happier than when I go to a page and I realize I can just, like, you know, hit the italicized button. I have to be typing, like, open, caret, close, or, you know, the greater sign, less than sign thing.
But it's one of those moments when you just feel like such a dork when you're watching a movie and you go, no, he wouldn't have had to have typed the closed paragraph code if he was using LiveJournal, because I used to be on LiveJournal, and I'm like,
it surprises me that Fincher would have made that mistake, though, that somebody wouldn't have caught that.
I was surprised by it.
I mean,
really was, because everything else seemed really, really authentic and really accurate.
Yeah, and he was when he was talking about the process he used to actually automate the downloading of the photos, which I think is all pretty accurate.
Yeah.
So all right, well, there you go. Were we doing something just now? Twitter, blah, blah, blah.
Thomas Gill is just sort of wanking away, writing things, mentioning things, and then finally he just finishes just by typing, WYSIWYG, with an exclamation point. I think his head just exploded.
I want to form a band called WYSIWYG. All right.
That's my favorite Dickens character, by the way, was Mr. and Mrs. WYSIWYG.
Well done. That's fantastic. There ought to be. That's like, you ought to sell that joke to Futurama. That would be like a futuristic Dickensian novel. And you'll be put into debtor's prison run by Warden WYSIWYG. That's a ruled Dahlian quality right there is what that is. All right. I had some observation about Roald Dahl I was going to make, but let's not do that now. Why were we just talking about Twitter?
I don't remember now.
Fail.
No, because of the hashtag for the Jonathan Franzen's glasses thing.
You know, Lara's listening to that book on, not even on tape, that's another old guy thing I got to quit doing, on audiobook. She's listening to that audiobook now, and it's, I don't know. I know I'm supposed to, never mind, it doesn't really matter. I'm not going to read it. Let's just leave it at that. I'm not going to read it.
Because it's supposed to be really, really good. I've read a couple of reviews of it.
It probably is really good. I just...
The word masterpiece has been getting tossed around.
You know, whatever. I sound like such a rube. I did fine.
I would read it, but I'm just too cheap to buy books. Too cheap / too poor. And the waiting list at the library is like 7 million miles long.
And here's the thing. If you sign up, and I don't think you have to have a smartphone to do this. Maybe you do, because that's what she's listening to it on. But she signed up for, I believe it was audible.com. And the thing is, if you sign up, And it's, you know, it's free. It's, you don't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. But if you're signing up, you get a free audiobook download, and that was hers, the unabridged Franzen novel.
But as I don't listen to audiobooks. I just actually read.
Okay, but I'm saying you're always, okay, listen, you damn woman, I'm trying to help you out here. You're always bitching about your car radio and how all you ever get, you can only get NPR, but NPR just sort of annoys you sometimes. Do you have a cassette deck in your car?
No.
What? Is it just a radio that does nothing else?
My car is like a 1986 and it has...
They had cassettes in 1986.
It has the original radio in it. But I don't have a cassette player.
Well, you're beyond help then. You can't be helped. You cannot be
I might have a cassette player and it just never occurred to me because I don't listen to cassettes.
But you really ought to. I mean, really, here's the thing. Audiobooks are... Once you start doing that, man, it's... Some things don't work as audiobooks, but some things really do. And I say this as a lifelong book snob. I'm a sort of a little Henry Bemis over here, but it's a fantastic thing
I don't want to open this whole can of worms, but I got to ask anyway. I know that there's a really good electronic book reader for the iPhone 4.
Yes, there is.
Is it only available for iPhone 4, or is there something similar that I could get if I get the 3GS?
Do you really want me to answer this? Because it is going to open the whole thing.
Yes, I want you to
answer. Or do you want to ask me again? You can ask me now, or you can ask me again tomorrow. It's your choice.
Do you want to hold this until tomorrow?
No, I'm leaving it up to you.
I want to know. I want to know now, because I'll forget by tomorrow.
Well, hold on a second. I just feel like, I got to drink a little Viso before I even tackle it. By the way, I'll just tell you this right now. So we'll do a few more stories. We'll do the top five. The greatest song ever, and probably the Lennon thing. We will probably move to another... Just because I'm going to just collapse in a heap of just neuroses and exhaustion at some point. And it's already been like a 9-hour show. Hold on. All right.
Well, I just got an answer from Thomas Gill.
I know.
Would you like to hear what he said before you give me your answer?
Go ahead. Yeah.
He writes, there is iBooks that works on the 4 and 3GS, or you can use the Kindle app and the Barnes & Noble app.
Yeah, that's the Kindle app works on, and that works on like your iPad.
iBooks
too,
works on any iOS 4 system, and since the 3GS uses the 4 operating system, then I guess therefore it would work.
Lara is using, she actually has, and this is for her Droid, not an iPhone, but for her, she just has the Motorola Droid, and she has the, I think there's a Kindle thing for that too, and then there's some other, their version of like the iBook reader or whatever. Anyway, so she said that those they would work fine. She's reading some. She reads an anthology, like a collection of short stories. She's not reading a novel on it or anything. I've seen not on the iPhone. I have seen on the iPad, where really the only difference there, for the most part, essentially, is just a matter of size. In other words, the resolution is not demonstrably different.
Is it annoying to read books on the iPhone? Because the iPad and the Kindle are relatively
large,
similar to actual book size.
I would say it's not annoying in the sense that it doesn't cause eye strain. It's not like your vision goes wonky after a while. It just is a question of – it's just a question of whether whether you can how do I put this? It's whether you can just sort of let go of the difference and just accept it as what it is. And that's like my thing with audiobooks is I'm a big audiobook fan, and it's not the same experience as reading, but but if you can get past that it's a comparable experience but not equivalent to, then you will have no problem with it. Obviously, a bigger screen is going to mean easier reading. But you know what? Here's what I would compare it to. I would compare it to watching television on your laptop after watching television sitting in the living room watching it on TV for a long time. If you're watching it on your laptop, and let's say not even full screen, if you're watching a TV show on your laptop on VLC or QuickTime or the Windows Media Player or whatever, where it's like this big, it's like 6x6, after watching it on a 40-inch television for 5 or 6 years, it's going to take you a couple weeks to sort of adjust to that. But at this point, seriously, here's what a nerd I am. Here's how much a child of the glass boob I am. That when I'm working on stuff, answering email, writing things at night, I actually will just watch television as, seriously, like a 1x2-inch frame in the upper right-hand corner of my screen. I will take the player. I will shrink it down to the size of like a matchbook, and I'll have that going while I'm working.
That's what I do when I catch up on a lot of TV. Well, yeah, in the mornings while I'm.
So
while
then
I'm
you
working,
should have no
so, yeah.
problem reading. I mean, if you look at the if you look at the screen size on this thing,
I wondered if you had to just keep scrolling like incessantly.
Well,
to
it doesn't
get through
listen
it because
to,
it's small.
It doesn't listen to you read, so I mean, it doesn't know when you're at the end of the page. But the scrolling, I hate to be this guy, but the scrolling on. Maybe the droid's the same way, but the scrolling on this thing is like, I mean, you basically breathe on the phone and it scrolls for you. It's, you know, so I would have my thing.
I read really fast. So if I'm just sitting, I mean, maybe I would get used to that, just my finger constantly flicking while
I'm
reading.
Somebody reads really fast. Now I feel like I have to bring up a page of text later.
You don't have to.
I'll do it after the show.
I was just curious because the answer could have been, it's like, no. That app's only available for the iPhone 4. And
no, I mean,
and that's not true.
My thing, I
keep forgetting the 3GS is essentially the 4. It's just a different body.
Well, that's not true, though. See, that's the thing. No, see, but that's the thing. And I won't go on and on about this because here's the thing. You're going to have people going on and on about it for me. Like, I don't need to do that. You're going to get it.
I just said that, and I'm sure I'll be getting.
Oh no! The next time you, the next time you talk to Bruce, he'll give you a whole lot. You know, if you're going to get the 3G, you might as well get the 4. Which is, here's the thing.
Which is easy to say if you've got like $200 extra lying around.
All I'm going to say is this: that I once thought as you did. I was planning when I moved to the iPhone to get the 3G, not the 4, and it's I planned on that.
It does have a slower processor.
The triumvirate of Thomas, Bruce, and Seamus, as they always do. And those three guys together cover the spectrum of, in other words, they all have slightly different reasons that kind of overlap for why to do it. The biggest reason for doing that, which they all kind of made, and Seamus sent me a long email kind of laying it out very reasonably without jabbing me in the virtual chest with his virtual finger and saying, "You're a fool," is that Apple has a cycle of like 3 years, basically, where they'll support their products and where updates and software and whatever will work for it. And after that, you start getting drop-off. It's like a conveyor belt, and things start falling off. Updates don't work. Newer versions of programs don't really function. Upgrades break things. And the point they made was, that it is more initially, but you are also basically buying yourself additional years of usage, whereas if you get the one that is like, at the end of the line as far as, like the older one, it's not going to be too long before stuff on that just doesn't work.
Well, and I will say I will once again revisit the whole $200 extra lying around. In 3 years, I'll be better able to afford a $300 phone.
I'm just
right
saying.
Now a $99 phone. It's going to cost me $200 to get this thing up and running anyway. When it comes to like buying the phone, the activation fees, paying for the first month, it's going to cost me about $200. So it's like there's two. So basically, to me, it's $200 versus $400.
Well, okay. It's actually only a $99 differential. It was $199.
Is it? I thought it was $299.
No, it was $199.
Well, if it's only a $100 difference, then maybe I'll think about it.
Oh, I see. Look who's suddenly missed money bags.
I have bills to pay, sir. Bills!
To end all of this with the Franzen conversation, which is where this whole cavalcade of nitwittery started, the thing about Franzen is I'm sure that book is great, but I didn't really care for the corrections. It wasn't a bad book. I just found it sort of uninteresting. Here's what I don't... here's the thing. It takes a lot to get me to read a book which is, sort of the decades-long, rise and, evolution and challenges faced by one American family. That's just a story I don't really care much about. The sort of American beauty syndrome where they just take like one family on one street and they just follow their trials and travails over generations. I just don't care. It's just a thing that tends to. I'm not saying it's bad. It's just not a kind of story that appeals to me.
I enjoy some of those books. Empire Falls by Richard Russo. Kind of a similar kind of a, it's about a family and things going on, but I think if those books are really super super well written, they can be quite awesome.
I guess I think my thing is always that there's like so much nonfiction to be read that it takes a lot to get me to pick up fiction because I just view it as there's just like so many that there's just so many nonfiction books that I need to get through right now.
Speaking of, we said we would do this earlier, so I should do it right now real quickly. Speaking of the corrections and the and Franz and all of that, you know, the rise and whatever of the American family, I should say that I finally watched Dexter last night, episode two, I guess, of season five. And it was yet another week where nothing happened. It was like a sort of this week on Dexter, not much. I mean, I guess stuff actually kind of happened in the sense that there were words being said and people were walking around and doing things, but the show didn't really seem to. And as a Wire fan, I shouldn't complain about a show taking a while to get up and running, because I mean, the Wire basically takes like, I mean, it takes like the first half of the first season to get its momentum because it's just like a novel. But let's be honest, Dexter ain't the Wire. Yeah. It's not anything like that. I mean, that's a show where it's a high concept program. Serial killer who kills other serial killers. Go. And it's like from the beginning, they should just dump you right in because it's basically just cotton candy. But he's found some creepy guy that kind of, you know, that he thinks is probably a serial killer because he kills animals and there's barrels behind the guy's house. It doesn't really matter. There's more weird sexual tension between Quinn and Deb, the sister. Mm-hmm. And it's more of a, but none of that really matters because the bulk of the show, the overwhelming majority of the show, again, is Dexter just sitting there wondering how to be a single dad in this crazy mixed-up world with his dead wife and the daughter, what's her name, Ariel or whatever her name is, you know, saying, I hate you, you're not my real dad. And I'm me just sitting there and going, why am I watching this? Because it has effectively just become an hour-long drama about the difficulty of being a single father. And I'm not saying that's not difficult. I'm saying, sure, it's difficult. I just don't want to watch a show about it. It's just not a thing that I care about as a program. And
I think I'm just going to call the Lithgow storyline the end of the show for me.
Well, that's, and I think I'm going to keep watching for a couple weeks to see if it somehow pulls itself out. I'll give it a few weeks, to, especially because Mad Men's going to end, so like I won't have so much to watch. But unless they really fix things and like fast, I'm going to be done with that show. What I am doing that with, where I'm calling at the end, I am almost certain. And you don't actually don't watch this show at this point anyway, but I am almost certain that I am not going to begin Californication again. I think I am going to treat last season's finale, which and
I gave up on that a lot quicker.
Last season's finale actually was good, perhaps the best episode that show ever had, and it actually functions perfectly as a series finale. In fact, I'll tell you, because you're probably... Are you ever going to watch the...
Probably not. I mean, I love me some David Duchovny, but I just haven't been able to go back to it.
Same thing with
Weeds. I just lost interest at some point.
So here's a little Californication spoiler for the third season. So if you haven't... if you have not watched the third season and you don't want to be spoiled, you turn off for like the next 20 seconds. I'll just tell you that the third season sucked. It sucked eggs just like nobody's business. It was horrible. It both sucked and blew. It was terrible. But the final episode, which almost certainly was written before the rest of the season was even done, it's nothing like any of the other episodes. There are no opening credits. It goes right to the action. There are almost no jokes. It's not funny. There is almost no laughter to be had. But it ends on like the most relentlessly down note. Marcy finally leaves Charlie for good. Duchovny's affair with the underage girl Mia is found out by Karen. Karen finds out. She finds out just as Becca and Karen and Hank are in fact packing to leave to go back to New York. It is revealed. She finds out. She tries to kick him out of the house. They fight. This is after he has already beaten Mia's boyfriend senseless and is covered in blood. And it ends with him actually being arrested and taken to jail while Becca sort of sees him being shoved into the back of the car. And it's all choreographed and done, and you don't hear any dialogue. It's all done in sort of a slow motion, and there's no dialogue. And it is a remixed version of Rocket Man, which is the song that ends the very first episode of the series. And I think that it was probably written to be a series finale. I don't think he thought he was going to get another season. I think Kapanos probably thought it was going to be done. And so it was written to be a bookend piece to the pilot. And it just ends with him just and the whole series, the whole episode has been punctuated by a recurring dream sequence where he's floating in a swimming pool at night, surrounded It's really creepy. He's floating in a chair in a swimming pool drinking at night, sort of like the Chris Holmes sequence in Decline of Western Civilization 2. And he is surrounded by all of the women that he's had affairs with, a great number of them, and Becca and Karen, and who are sort of these weird siren-y ghostly voices. And that recurs throughout the episode. And at the end, after he's shoved into a squad car and he's arrested, and his girlfriend Karen has dumped him, and he's been revealed as a statutory rapist, and his daughter has seen him arrested, and he's lost his agent, and his agent's lost the wife, and everything has gone to hell. And it's playing this Rocket Man song, and then it just shows him finishing off the bottle and just sinking to the bottom of the swimming pool, and it just fades to black. And it's just the most relentlessly down.
Wow.
But it's just freaking brilliant. I mean, it's just amazing. It's far and away the best episode that series ever had. So good.
So where did they pick back up again?
I can't even. I mean, I don't even imagine. I mean, it starts in a couple of months.
Oh, okay.
And they've already announced the casting for it and the whatever. And I. But it's. And I just don't. The only thing that might make me watch it is that. This is, you'll appreciate this. You're a child of the 80s in some way. You were there at least.
I was there.
That they, there's that in Californication that, Mia, the girl, stole Hank's book and she called it Effing and Punching, and she put it out. And it's basically about Hank having sex with an underage girl. So in the series, in Californication, they are making her book, Effing and Punching, into a movie. And the character of Hank Moody in Effing and Punching is being played by Rob Lowe, who in real life got in trouble for effing a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
So that's sort of great.
Yeah.
That, the season, which had been terrible, ended so brilliantly and with what was obviously meant to be a series finale. And I really do love that show, which is why it hurt. It just hurt me like in the deepest place to see so much potential, because Duchovny's such a great actor.
He is.
When he's given the right material. And they just, whizzed it all away with a terrible, and it just killed me to see such a great show go down the crapper. So I think I'm actually going to pull the ripcord and just remember it while it's still young and pretty, before it just starts to suck. But I think with Dexter, I'll give it a few weeks, but it's like...
Well, if it pulls itself out and it sounds like it's worth dealing with, I'll go back and catch up.
I don't hold out hope.
But I'm gonna leave this one to you.
Yeah, I'll take the bullet for you. The bottom line for me is that, like, and I'm surprised that nobody's pointed this out. I haven't seen anybody mention this. Is that he is, by definition, I mean literally, not figuratively, literally, he is no longer the same character, by which I mean he's not a sociopath any longer.
No.
Because he has the whole thing of, like, he now has feelings. He's the boy who can cry. And he says the thing at the funeral, who loved Rita like I did. And
Except he thought that in his head. That was the interesting thing about that. It was like I waited for him to actually say it out loud. And the like I did was in voiceover. It was still in his head. So apparently he still can't actually say that out loud comfortably.
Well, he said it last night. He said it to Ariel, the daughter. He told the daughter that he loved her.
Oh,
okay. And I'm like, well, which is fine. It's not like I'm opposed to love. But, like, you can't be a sociopath and be, like, that's what a sociopath is. They don't have human feelings.
It feels very much like a show where they just kept going in a certain direction and they didn't know what to do with it. Because, once they, the whole idea of the relationship with Rita was fascinating in that he couldn't be in a real relationship,
right,
and that he thought it would be a good cover, and that also I think it's just sort of like, hey, this is what normal people do, so I will be here now.
And they had the great plot device where she never wanted to have sex because she'd been repeatedly
right.
abused by her husband, and it worked out perfectly,
But then they just kept pushing it and pushing it and pushing it with the sex and the kids and the family, and once you actually introduce that, and once they integrated him into that whole family dynamic, that honestly, I just don't think they knew what to do with it.
Well, there's no way out of it.
Still don't.
Yeah, and it's like you can't kill off the kids, probably. So there's no way out of the problem. That's the thing. Is like they painted themselves into this corner that you can't escape from.
Well, if he gave the kids back to the grandparents and then just went back about his business.
The kids last night kept asking to go live with the grandparents, and it's like I kept thinking, like, let that be a permanent change, please.
Yes.
Let that happen, because otherwise he's just otherwise. He's just another single dad with an anger problem.
I mean, I really thought in the first episode, I thought that he was going to get on his boat and just take off. And now, hey, great, we're going to see this. The season is going to be Dexter leaving and going elsewhere and having other adventures. And I guess, meanwhile, back at the ranch, the police department's going to wonder what happened to him and start looking for him. But still, we're going to get to see Dexter on his own again, doing what he does.
No luck. All right. Have we done the final news break? Is there any news we need to get to? Have we gotten to all of our watches, our everything? We did our taser watch, clergy watch.
Yep.
Let's see. I want to make sure. Hold on. From the opening of the show, that I didn't. There was nothing I teased here at the beginning.
I did mention this message in a bottle story, and we didn't.
Let's do that. The greatest songs ever made. We will do that tomorrow when we talk to Kelly Clark as well. And then I'll probably do the Lennon audio tomorrow. Don't forget to join us on Thursday. We'll have Bill Carter, author of Fools Rush In, and listener Jenny Hieronymus will be here to do her top five. And we had something happening Friday, too, but I've blocked it all out. I can't even think of what it is. Here's Don Taylor, ladies and gentlemen.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
A message in a bottle sent, dropped in the ocean in Florida 16 months ago, has been found in Ireland.
I'm sorry, this is dropped in the ocean in where? Hold on. There we go. Awesome.
It's been found in Ireland. Corey Swearingen says he sent it out to sea and forgot about it.
The goal was to basically see how the ocean currents work and how the Gulf Stream flows, and it eventually landed in Ireland.
It was Walter White's kid.
He says it was a high school science experiment, and he never thought anything would come of it.
I was excited and amazed that my model traveled all the way across the Atlantic Ocean.
Seriously, do you watch Breaking Bad?
No.
Okay, Breaking Bad fans in the house will know what I'm talking about. This is Walter Jr. from Breaking Bad.
I was excited and amazed that my model traveled all the way across the Atlantic Ocean.
Jesus, God. That's just uncanny. All right.
Speaking of Swearingen, I am totally going to give you that.
Speaking of Swearingen.
Swearingen. His name's Corey Swearingen.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to give you that first season box set of Deadwood to read, to watch.
I've got that.
Do you?
Yeah, I've got the first season of Deadwood.
You didn't. I thought you were the one. I thought you said you hadn't watched Deadwood.
If I said that, I guess it was both right and wrong, because I watched it and I saw the ending of it. It was only the first season, but I didn't see every episode.
All right.
There were places where I just, you know, I sort of dropped out or I forgot to watch it or something.
That was just brilliant. Was just genius.
I have not watched it front to back. I probably should go back and watch it in order to make sure that I get every episode. But I watched it when it started, and then I caught it sort of sporadically. I mean, there was only the one season of however many episodes there were.
There were two seasons.
I thought it was just one.
Yeah, could be wrong. I thought it was two.
Maybe it was two. Well, in any event, but I saw it, and then I saw it sporadically, and then I saw it when it ended, where it just ended really abruptly.
Well, yeah, and because it got canceled because
they didn't get to close it out. But
they'd
promised
that they would be able to, and then something happened.
Yeah, so I haven't seen the whole series. I have not seen all of the episodes. I liked what I saw, but it did take me a while to acclimate myself to it, because it's got that strange structure, because it's all written rhythmically, and so it's got that strange
uber post-Shakespearean kind of, you know, dialogue going on.
Well, it is. It is actually, the show is entirely written in iambic pentameter, which is, so it's got that weird sort of, shall I compare thee to a summer's day kind of rhythm to it.
But with a lot of F words.
Yeah, but with like Calamity Jane saying, look at my vagina, or whatever. Except she doesn't really ever say that.
She doesn't say that. She never references her vagina at all.
Can I just tell you this? I had the weirdest vagina moment the other day. I had the weirdest moment.
Can we tie this to the stuffing the baguette in your
mouth? I should Twitter this right now with a hashtag of vagina. And it gets weirder. Aaron's wife, Jen, was going out with my wife the other night. They go out and they look at kittens together or whatever, you know, whatever it is the girls do. Ride a calliope or something. But they were going out somewhere. And so Jen is sort of the stunt husband sometimes. And if Lara wants to go out and, like, booze it up, she will then go to the Rolodex of girlfriend she has. And so she was going out with Jen's wife or with Aaron's wife, Jen. And so Jen pulls up and Lara's like, okay, Jen's here. You know, I'll be back later. And I'm like, all right, to have fun storming the castle or whatever. And so she'd leave me, and I walk on the front porch, and I do the, you know, the dopey staying-at-home husband thing, waving, hi, Jen, waving on the porch. And Jen opens the door of her car so that Lara can get in. And as Jen throws open the door of her car, you know, people do that, and you hear the music coming out that they're listening to. So she was listening to, just as she opens the car door to let my wife in, she was listening to Storm's Crazy Enough album. And it was right at that point where it is literally my own voice singing that vagina, vagina, vagina part, which she didn't intend. It just worked out that way. And that's a surreal moment.
Yeah.
When Aaron's wife is there to pick up my wife, she opens the door of her car and it's my own voice coming from her stereo singing about Storm Large's vagina. And you just think to yourself, like, what is going on in this world? Like, what kind of a strange origami life do I have where everything is folded in on itself?
Like, so, a vagina.
See, yes, exactly like that, Don. That was odd. All right, let's, should we do the top five?
Oh, yes.
The sooner we do the top five, the sooner I can go home and eat this cookie that you've made.
Oh, yeah.
Here is your top five for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
5, 4, 3, 2.
People are on the text box demanding another pee
fire.
Break.
Wonderful, counting is marvelous, counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness, counting is ecstasy. I love to count, don't you?
By the way, somebody says, hey, about the business of you stuffing your bread, stuffing, about the bread stuffing business, where I injured myself with the bread and then the cheese, and I had the sort of Thurber-esque disaster with my foodstuffs. Stories like this make me wish that Lara had a secret camera hidden in some rooms of the house, or maybe all of them, so that she could see what happens when she isn't home. Maybe she does. Maybe I should check YouTubes, Rick. All right. After
A nanny cam in the kitchen so that later, when she comes back into town, we can all just sit around and watch this time-lapse photography of you going in and out of the kitchen and doing
trying
God
to
only knows what.
Injuring myself.
All the pizza boxes growing up in the corner.
It's like all of the home videos would just be like fail blog entries, though, where I was just trying to eat cheese and then choking and then hurling or something. And then, okay, well, we'll get to these others here after the top five. This is your top five for Tuesday. These are the, you have your own copy of the list there?
I do.
These are the top five horror movie scores, the scariest horror movie scores. Now, is it in terms of quality or in terms of fear inducement?
This is in terms of just purely, yeah.
Creep factor.
The ones that I find the scariest, that the music itself, you know, they're scary movies, but also the music itself just kind of gives me the heebie-jeebies.
These are the top five scariest horror movie themes of all time in the assessment of Don Taylor. What is honorable mention?
Honorable mention is John Carpenter's The Thing by Ennio Morricone.
Now, this is what I was talking about earlier when I said I didn't know he did that. It's been a while since I haven't seen The Thing. They made the Carpenter version for a long, long time. So hold up.
Oh God, yes. I saw it last year around Halloween. I watch it probably about every couple of years, and even though I have seen it so many times, I could practically like recite the dialogue along with it. It just scares me every time I see it.
You know, Lara's never seen that, so maybe that'd be a good time for me to rewatch it, is to have her watch it.
Yeah, it is a damn scary movie.
This is a creepy score. So this is Ennio Morricone?
It is.
He of Good, Bad, and the Ugly?
Yeah, dude, he scored the Sergio Leone spaghetti westerns and such.
I was going to say young people. You old people in the house will recognize Ennio Morricone as the man who wrote Metallica's stage entrance music, oh. Ecstasy of Gold. It's weird because you're so used to hearing him doing the, like, El Dorado, you know.
Yeah.
You know, coming over the horizon, you know, with the cavalry music.
But doesn't this music just make you feel like something horrible is about to happen?
Seriously. And it is, by the way. Ugh, it's freaking me out.
And it's so simple.
It sort of is great, by the way. We should just see if this were a television program, I would be able to do the gag of, like, this show ending with you and I just sitting and staring at each other. As the snow falls. Okay, we have to... I was going to have to go on, but they're all going to be like this.
They are all going to be
like
this.
Damn you, woman. All right, these are the top five scariest horror movie scores. Well done.
Number five is Cape Fear, the remake from 1991.
Yeah.
Music by Bernard Herrmann.
Bernard Herrmann, who might show up later on the list.
He might indeed.
And also did a lot of the music for The Twilight Zone. How do you feel about the remake of Cape Fear?
I liked it. I mean, I'm a huge Scorsese fan, so I really liked it as a Scorsese film. But I really love the original film as well. I don't think De Niro was as effective as Robert Mitchum was in the original. But I really liked the creepy sort of sexy kind of relationship that he created with De Niro and Juliette Lewis, which didn't really exist in the original.
I'm the do-right man.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing that ruins, I didn't want to ruin, the only thing I don't like about the remake is his whole, like, unkillable thing at the end where he becomes Jason Voorhees.
Yeah.
Just coming out of the water like 100 times. But it is, he's really good, and the whole thing with him and Juliette Lewis is great. And they do almost a better job in the remake of sort of illustrating the whole, like, marital strife aspect of it. Mm-hmm. The Jessica Lange, Nick Nolte thing, where it's like the tension between the two of them. But Robert Mitchum is just so great. He's such a towering presence.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's, yeah, he his performance in Cape Fear is one of his best. And that's just an amazing film. It was actually based on the John D. MacDonald novel, The Executioners, by the way.
I didn't know that. Mm. So is this the same score they use in the original?
I don't think so.
I don't think it is either. I thought Bernard Herrmann would have been dead by the time they did this remake, but
no,
maybe not.
His last, his actual last score was Basket Case 2.
Basket Case 2. I didn't even know there was a Basket Case 2.
Yeah, nobody did. I used to have it on vinyl. It was,
wow.
It was very sad. And it was really just a reboot
Stephen
of
First?
A bunch of stuff he'd written before. But
did it even have Stephen First in it? He's
you're thinking of Humongous.
I am thinking of Humongous. That's where he has the teddy bear and the,
yeah.
Okay, that's, no, okay, I'm thinking of something else altogether. Yeah. All right, never mind. Boy, it's really dumb that you knew that. These are the top five horror movie scores of all time.
Number four, The Shining by Rachel Elkind and Wendy Carlos.
It's just claustrophobic sounding.
As it's supposed to be.
I like to think that somewhere there's a guy listening to this later on, like, that either someone is listening to this live, like in Belgium right now, or someone is listening to this via podcast and they're working the night shift at a store where they're the only employee and they've got this on their headphones.
But this just sounds like Kubrick's movie. I mean, it sounds cold.
Right.
And it sounds big and majestic and scary.
Back on I hope we're inadvertently terrifying somebody with this, somebody who downloaded this podcast and is listening to it as they work the graveyard shift, not knowing what they were in for. I should say, as great as this music is, and as great as some of the iconography is in that film, I don't find The Shining scary, the movie, and I never have.
No.
The book is scary. The book is terrifying as hell.
Yeah.
I don't find Kubrick's Shining to be scary. I find it to be creepy and sort of disturbing in some of the imagery again and the way that it's sort of the production design of it, but I don't find it scary.
Well, Kubrick wasn't really a horror director. He was making a movie that his movie was more an examination of the disintegration of the family.
Right.
It was less, you know, the Stephen King horror. And King tried to kind of correct that because King always hated the Kubrick film, and he tried to correct it a few years ago with a
made for TV one, right?
Which that just went in the direction of making it all about the guy's, like, recovering alcoholism.
Right.
And it was awful. It was just terrible.
Stephen King thing, if you've never read it, I'll bring that at some point, bring that Stephen King companion, because Harlan Ellison has this analysis about why it is so hard to make good. Because he says, you know, he's like, Stephen King ought to be the easiest person to adapt because his movies are so cinematic. They play in your mind so much like, you know, little two or three real horror films. And he said, so why don't they work as movies? And he has a long analysis of it.
Yeah, and I don't know what Ellison says, but from my opinion, the reason that King works on paper is because he spends a lot of time letting you be inside the skin of the characters. And then creepy, weird stuff happens to the characters, which they don't really understand why. And you're experiencing it through the characters.
Right.
And which is unusual for horror, because most horror, like science fiction and fantasy, is all about the what and the how. The writers are so in love with explaining their universe and explaining their gizmos and explaining their ghosts and their monsters. And King isn't. King is more interested in how people respond when there are monsters.
Right.
And I think it's really, really hard in a movie, because in a movie, pretty much everything is you're looking at everything from the outside. And in his books, you're looking at everything from the inside. And they're completely different. That's just my
I'm with you on that. His characters have great internal monologues. And I was also thinking when you just said the monsters that I was trying to think of the best example of this, but maybe it's just, you know, it sort of happens in all of his books where he sort of slowly, figuratively anyway, kind of locks people into a room or paints them into a corner. And then once they're locked in the room, then he just sort of lets in, you know, whatever the goblin in the basement is. Yeah. And his whole thing is then how do they react? And the best adaptations, actually, are about how people react to the monsters. Like, The Mist is the most recent example of that.
Well, it is a good example in that I think most horror writers would be really important to them to explain to you why a clown.
Right.
What's the background of the clown? Where does the clown come from? With The Shining, for example, they would want to tell you, why is this hotel evil? Why is this here? And he never bothers to tell you that. He's not interested in explaining the mechanics of how evil came to be.
It's just what it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, we have to do this. Music's creeping me out. These are the top five scariest horror scores in the assessment of Don Taylor.
Number three, Jaws.
Seriously.
By John Williams.
See, this is just... can I just... Hold on, just stop this for a second. Can I just tell you... I am in a studio in Portland, Oregon. Also, I'm like 40, so, you know, there's no reason why this needs to creep me out except that I am goddamn terrified of the water.
Even with the curtains closed, you can see that there's bright sunlight outside.
And we're like, you know, in a train yard, basically. Yeah. So, you know, there's the whole story about how and I don't know if it's true or not, but how they tested this movie without the score and it was like a 70, and then they tested it with the score and it was like a 95.
Yeah.
The music
really does help to make this movie.
And the thing that, again, another one thing that Steven Spielberg gets credit for, although it was accidental, is the realization that, like, the music is the shark. Because, you know, you never hear the quintessential da-na-da-na. You actually never hear that if it's a red herring. No. You only hear that when the shark is actually there. All right, so I'll shut up now and let everybody sort of appreciate John Williams.
That's just such an amazing and just such a simple.
It's primal,
tone.
Is what it is. I mean, it almost sounds like, and I think Williams has said it in something, it almost sounds like a parody of a sinister score. It almost sounds like a satire of menace, but it really works.
Yeah. And it does. It's the sound of something after you.
Yeah. Well, it almost sounds like footsteps. And halting footsteps at that.
Also, my friend DK Holm, who's a film critic here locally, he once said over several beers that he thinks Jaws is the greatest American film. And honest to God, I think he may be right. It's one of those movies like Chinatown that is a near-perfect movie.
I don't know that I could disagree with that. Well, we've had this discussion for many years off and on about is there such a thing as a perfect film and what would it be? I can't think of anything about Jaws that is wrong. I can't think of a misstep in that movie.
Yeah, there's nothing in it that doesn't work.
Yeah, and there's no moment where you go like, oh, God, except for that one line where, you know, movies that are ruined by a single bad scene or whatever. I can't think of anything about Jaws that is done wrong.
This is the Prague Symphony Orchestra doing the theme from Jaws, by the way.
No wonder it sounds evil. I mean, I'm a huge, huge Jaws fan. I am just, I'm a massive fan of that film. And augmented by the fact that I'm terrified of the water and of sea creatures who are clearly in it, and who are real, by the way. I saw this for the first time when I was... pretty young. I mean, it was like in the early days of VHS rentals when you had to rent the VCR like in a plastic suitcase. And this actually was Psycho were the two films I ever rented as a wee lad. Again, like, I don't know what my parents were thinking. My parents weren't even around. I could have rented porn, probably, or snuff films. But I rented this in Psycho. And I remember this movie I was maybe 11 or so. And it just, like, scarred me, like, in the deepest place. But I found myself, I copied it, you know, of course, because that's what you did. You hooked the two VCRs together. And I watched it every day for weeks, it seemed like, because it was so good.
Well, the thing about Jaws is also, it is another film. It was made in 1975. And it's another one of those films that you don't really think about the difference in movie violence in the 70s and today. But it is a movie that would not make it into theaters as it was released in 75,
oh, yeah.
Much
yeah.
less be shown on television.
Oh, yeah.
There is the scene where Robert Shaw, the shark finally, like, takes a huge big bite out of the boat.
Yeah.
The boat is sinking, and Robert Shaw slides down the deck of the ship into the shark's mouth, and that's brutal. It's terrifying and scary,
yeah,
and brutal, and it happens to a main character.
Oh yeah.
And that simply wouldn't happen in a movie today.
Well, and the other thing about this movie, here's the other reason why Jaws is not only, you know, I'd certainly put it in the top 10 all-time American films. Maybe the greatest. I don't know. The top five. I don't have a reason why it's not on the list. So, I mean, it is. But I don't have an argument against it being the greatest film. It's also, to my mind, it is probably the greatest Spielberg film, period. And here's the thing about it, is like, it's also a film that Spielberg would never make today.
Yeah.
Because there's a very clear contrast between Jaws, and then the polar twin of Jaws is Jurassic Park. And I remember watching Jurassic Park, which is a great movie in many ways. It's a great thrill ride. It's a sort of roller coaster. Jaws is not really a roller coaster, because a roller coaster implies that everybody gets off at the other side safe and well. This is sort of like a trapdoor haunted house. And the scene in Jurassic Park that underscores to me why you should never have children, because it ruins you as an artist most of the time, it's the sequence in Jurassic Park when the kids are sleeping in the tree with, I always want to say Sam Elliott, but isn't that Sam Neill?
Sam Neill.
The kids have fallen asleep in a tree after, you know, spending a night being pursued by a T-Rex that, like, ate a guy right in front of them, being chased, I think, through the kitchen by, like, velociraptors, and it's like, you know, they're in a park filled with dinosaurs. They fall asleep in a tree, and what's her name? Ariana Richards, the girl, is woken up by a dinosaur, like, licking the side of her face. And Sam Neill goes, no, it's okay, it just eats plants. And she, like, pets it and giggles.
Yeah.
That's not happening. To say that she would be in shock is like an understatement. One of those kids would have been eaten, probably. And the fact that Spielberg could not, this sounds terrible, but that he could not bring himself to kill off one of the kids in that movie, that shows you how he changed as a filmmaker. In Jaws, I mean, he does not only does he not hesitate to kill off a kid, he kills off a kid in a really bloody, like a fountain of blood fashion. And he wouldn't do that now.
Jurassic Park is sort of, in its way, a companion piece to E.T. as far as just, like, adorable kids and everything turning out okay.
Right.
Whereas Jaws is more of a companion piece to Close Encounters, which is still also another near-perfect film. It's intense, and it's about just insanity and consequence and government conspiracy.
Right.
And it's another movie that is something that you just can't really imagine Spielberg ever making a movie like that ever again.
Yeah, and the other difference between those two films is that, like, Close Encounters and Jaws are both about the disintegration of the family, because, you know, it's Brody leaving home, and even though at the end he's paddling back to shore with Hooper, he's still away from the family, whereas Jurassic Park and, like, War of the Worlds and with the reunion of the American family. And that is, you know, all Spielberg has all of these, like, weird daddy issues in his films, where every single movie has an absent father in some way. Every single Spielberg film I can think of has an absent father. But it's like, that's the thing where he just sort of, I don't want to say he went soft, but it's like he just doesn't, you know, Toby Hooper, who made Texas Chainsaw Massacre, said the greatest thing about, in fact, this is a good chance to move on to number two, actually, Don Taylor. These are top five scariest horror film themes, scores.
Number two would be Psycho, Bernard Herrmann.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's my fault. I had the two. There we go. By the way, the Dust Brothers had that great moment in Paul's Boutique where they merged the Jaws score and the Psycho score against each other, and it's just freaking awesome.
Everyone always thinks of the immediately thinks of the shower scene music in Psycho, but there's a number of different themes and different set pieces in Herman's score that happen. Like, this is the beginning when Janet Leigh has stolen the money,
$40,000,
and she's driving through town, and she's just, you know, has kind of gotten away with it, but she stops at the light and she sees a cop, and the cop is looking at her, and she's not sure if she's going to get away with it. And it's basically on screen, not a lot is really happening. She's in a car and she's driving around. This music actually, you know, puts you in that place where you understand the level of tension that she's experiencing.
Well, it's like emotional jangling.
Yeah, it's just brilliantly evocative and very necessary to what's going on screen.
Psycho is a film that really holds up. If you watch Psycho now, if people can if they can change their expectations. In other words, if people realize it's not, because people just know the shower scene. And so people go, if you go into Psycho expecting it to be a thriller in the conventional sense, where there's, you know, if people go into Psycho expecting it to be Scream, where there's a death every 9 minutes, yeah, you're going to be disappointed. It's a big psychological build.
Yeah, it's more of a suspense film than a horror film, really.
And but it really is. It's just a really, really great film. And but Tobe Hooper said this great thing. He said, talked about seeing Psycho in the theater. And here's another thing people don't really appreciate is how unexpected and uncommon it was to kill a main character.
Yeah.
Because Janet Leigh was a huge star when this movie came out. And you know, and it was just unheard of that you would set her up as the main star, not even hint that there's going to be another main star. You wouldn't even allude to the fact that there was another star. And then, hey, here's the, you know, stage and screen star, Janet Leigh. Oh, my God, she's dead! You know, and then it was just, and Tobe Hooper said he was in the theater watching that as a kid and didn't know what was going on. And he said that, sort of like I said earlier, there are movies that pick you up and they're sort of a thrill ride, and then everybody gets off and, you know, the movie puts you back safe and sound. And he said that he was watching Psycho, and as soon as Hitchcock killed off Janet Leigh, and to be fair, it wasn't like Hitchcock did that. I mean, Robert Block did that in the novel. But as soon as the movie killed off Janet Leigh, which is the sort of thing that they might change now, especially if it was a prominent actress, he said he looked around in the theater and he said he realized that, in his words, the movie had been made by a bad person, and that he was no longer safe, that he was like in the hands of crazy people. And that it wasn't like the movie was taking you by the hand and saying, let's have a fun walk through the haunted house. He said, like, he was in the hands of an untrustable filmmaker, where, like, there were no landmarks. He looked around. He didn't recognize anything. He was wandering through this film with a director who didn't care about him and who didn't care if he was, like, traumatized or scarred or, you know, if he was just, like, emotionally damaged by the movie. That was, in fact, you know, not a concern. That he was in the movie was being made by untrustable people. And that's what he was trying to do with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, is to erase the level of that, like, there were no friends in the movie.
Well, Joe Bob Briggs, one of his qualifications for something being a terrific horror movie, how good was the film? One of his rules for good horror was, anyone can die at any time.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, Psycho really is, it's a great film. Even with the piece at the end, which a lot of people don't like. Roger Ebert hates the whole sequence at the end with the shrink coming out, Arbogast, and coming out and explaining the nature of Norman Bates' craziness. And I don't. I actually love that that little speech at the end. I like the red ribbon of it.
I think it's also something that you also have to watch the film within the context of when it was 1960. No one had ever seen a movie even remotely like this before, where you kill a main character early on and it's completely unexpected, and in a manner of graphic violence that had never been seen before. Even though pretty much everything in the shower scene is implied,
right,
people did walk out of that film swearing that they saw the knife entering her body.
Oh, yeah.
And so, I think it was kind of necessary to create sort of a little safe area, a little cushion at the end of the movie for people before you brought the lights back up and sent them back on their way.
Also, depending on where you see the movie and depending on what print of it you see, because Hitchcock was undecided about this till the very end, depending, and you will still see this show up every now and again. They don't show Psycho much on TV anymore. But depending on where you rent it and depending on, like, if you see it on, like, TBS or something late at night, about a quarter of the prints of Psycho that are that are shown. I don't know how movies are distributed now, probably digitally or whatever, you know, how a TV network gets it. But about a quarter of The Prince of Psycho, the final shot of Norman Bates sitting in the chair, talking like his mother and going, she wouldn't even hurt a fly. Hitchcock overlaid an almost, people say subliminal, which is wrong because that means you don't see it. But it's a very subtle image of a skull over Bates's face. I don't think I've ever seen it on television. I went online and watched it because somebody had put it on YouTube. And they said, here's the version with the skull. And it's completely creepy.
I didn't realize there were two versions.
Because Hitchcock was undecided about that until the very end. Oh. He thought it was too much. And so I think the deal is that he released it with that, but then he took that out and he replaced it in most theaters with the one that doesn't have it because he was so undecided. He thought it was like one stroke too many with the brush. But you'll actually see that crop up occasionally in video stores. It's totally creepy. All right, there we go. There's the number two most terrifying film score of all time in the assessment of Don Taylor. What is number one, Don?
Number one would be Halloween, and the music was actually done by John Carpenter.
You want to talk about a bear? This is Halloween. Is this Halloween or Halloween 2?
This is Halloween. I mean, you know, he revisited the theme in the movies that would come, but this is original theme from Halloween.
I shouldn't have second-guessed you in that way. I shouldn't have thought that you would bring in the wrong thing. Of course you wouldn't.
And I'm not a fan of Carpenter's scores as a rule. Like, his score for The Fog sounds just like this.
Right.
You know, his music for, like, Big Trouble in Little China is really, but this is just a brilliant theme.
Yeah. Well, if you look at all of these, actually, like if you look at Jaws, if you look at Psycho, if you look at Halloween, especially, they're minimalist. There's not a lot of moving parts in these. I mean, this is basically one musical figure repeated for like a thousand, you know, bars or whatever. But it does what it needs to do. I mean, I actually know people who our good friend Jolie, she of the How Chicks Think segment many, many years ago, she actually couldn't be in the room if this came on. People would have their ringtones or something. So this would be like, I have to leave the room. And she would just walk because it freaked her out so badly.
Yeah, we were talking about the ringback tones before, the last 2 years around Halloween, I would put this on as my ringback tone. And I've had people tell me that they would just hang up and not leave a message.
I should try
and
that.
Not wait because they just hated it so much. They just didn't want to listen to it.
I'd like to hear some sort of musicologist explain why it's creepy. I mean, it is. But I don't know why. There's got to be some chemical reason in your brain why it's unnerving. I mean,
because it's not just a memory of the movie. It is, in and of itself, just scary to listen to.
I bet people were freaked out the first time they heard it. And people say, well, it's, you know, minor keys or it's whatever. But there's got to be some particular thing that this kind of music does. You know, Halloween 2, I was actually referencing. The Halloween sequels get a bad rap. And Halloween 2 is actually not bad. Halloween 2 is a pretty decent sequel.
Halloween, is it Halloween 3, Season of the Witch?
Yes, it is.
Which is a terrible movie.
Awful.
Terrible. And it's a shame, too, because it's got a great idea. It's a great idea, but it has nothing to do with the Halloween franchise.
Yeah.
But it has a great idea, but it's also really badly executed. But the one good thing that comes from that movie is that creepy, creepy song.
Happy, happy
Eight
Halloween.
8 days until Halloween. Yeah. Silver shamrock.
Okay, it's creepy that we both just did that right there. Years ago, like many years ago, when I was at the radio in another state, actually, when it would get to be Halloween, we actually would play that every single... I was doing a morning show, and we would play that every morning just to freak out like the 5% of the audience that knew what it was. It was the Silver Shamrock song from Halloween 3. Halloween 5, I think, actually was... had moments where it was actually sort of good, and I think that's where I got off the wagon. And so I saw that horrible H2O thing. I don't even know why I decided to watch that.
The one they made a couple of years ago, was it 10? The one where Jamie Lee Curtis came back?
That was H2O.
Was that H2O? Yeah. Yeah.
I guess. It was the one where they had Busta Rhymes or somebody in it?
I don't remember.
I don't know. And then... I don't know. I don't know what you think about the Rob Zombie thing, but I...
No, the Rob Zombie thing, I liked... the whole origin story prequel stuff, and then once he got into the body of the story and it became almost a shot-for-shot remake of the... There didn't seem to be much point.
Yeah.
But when he was left to his own devices and was just making stuff up about the crazy family and him, like, stitching together his own little masks, and I thought that was actually kind of cool.
I remember just seeing that sequence where he's sitting on the curb and they're playing Love Hurts on the soundtrack, you know, the Nazareth, and I remember just thinking... That was the moment where I think the movie just sort of went off the rails for me. He was trying to do this weird... I don't even know if he was trying to be funny or if he was trying to be bleakly funny. Yeah. But it's like his stripper mom and the trashy boyfriend and whatever. And then the kids, Michael Myers sitting in the curb and "Love Hurts" on the soundtrack. And I was just thinking, what is going on in this film?
And of course, Rob Zombie keeps casting his wife as like these trashy, slutty, crazy people in movies, which just, that seems... weird.
I would like to see, I want him to be forced to make a movie without hillbillies. That's my thing. That is the thing that is so tired to me. It's so thin, the hillbilly killer thing.
I did really, really like is a weird word to use in this concept, but I really did like Devil's Rejects.
That seems to be the best film that he's done so far in the assessment of most people.
You know, I don't ever want to watch it again, but I really admired what he was doing there, and I think he did what he was trying to do really, really well. Whereas The House of a Thousand Corpses was awful.
No, I remember watching that and just thinking,
awful.
This is terrible. It was a terrible, terrible film. Well, we mentioned this last week. The great thing about Halloween is you noted how desolate and empty Haddonfield is, which I think is probably just because they couldn't afford any extras or set dressing.
Yeah.
So they just thought, like, well, we'll just have no one be home. And so as a result, Laurie Strode's, like, running down the street, knocking at doors and whatever, and, like, there's just no one around. It's like they've all moved to another city.
But that is just scary, though. There are a couple of things that... There are things that are just primally frightening, and one is having having something chase you. It's sort of the physical equivalent of the nightmare where you scream but no sound comes out.
Right,
and it's like you're like running up to people's doors and knocking, and no one is coming to help you. I think it was Day of the Dead. Was that the one in the shopping mall?
No, it was Dawn of the Dead.
Is that Dawn of the Dead?
Yeah.
Dawn of the... Okay. Oh, Night of the Living Dead. Yeah, then Dawn of the Dead. Yeah. In the shopping mall, there is this just one moment where the zombies are like up against the glass.
Right.
Trying to get into the mall, and they're pressing and pounding and pressing. And that just scares the hell out. That was the scariest thing in that entire movie to me. It's just like that and that... And similarly to Halloween, the scariest thing to me in Halloween is that scene... where he's just walking down the middle of the street and there's no one to help her.
And that actually, that scene is great because it also, it avoids one of the big, logic pitfalls in a lot of those movies where it's like the killer is walking and the heroine is running and yet somehow he catches her.
Yeah.
But they do it really well by just having, you know, there's nowhere for her to go and she keeps stopping at houses thinking somebody's got to be home and yet no one is. And that is actually a thing that you sort of buy. Like it just sort of works that there's no one around. And the... Rod Serling said that the deepest fear is the fear of the unknown preying upon you that you cannot share with someone else, which is typically the whole like, you must believe me, Sheriff. I'm not crazy. There is a blob. But it works her there because there's no one around. And so it is like the fear that no one else shares with her because they're all up, you know, upstairs or asleep or gone having a good time. And she's like alone being menaced by some nutcase in a Shatner mask. So, all right. And now I'm all freaked out. All right. Well, there you go. And you know, the thing is, and it's only October 5th. It's all very exciting. So we have like endless top fives we can devise between now and the end of... you know what I got the other night? I haven't watched it yet. I did the weirdest thing. I rented a movie from a video store. It was very strange.
Who does that?
Me. And, you know, and then I realized almost immediately why I don't do that, because they've been sitting in my car for like 4 days.
Yeah.
You know, what I have yet to watch, I've never seen this. I've only ever read the book. I did not know that there was an animated film of The Halloween Tree by Ray Bradbury, which is one of my favorite books. Have you ever read The Halloween Tree?
No.
Oh, it's awesome. It's great. It's so freaking great. It's very is fantastical really a word?
Yes.
Okay. But it's fantastical. It's, in other words, it's not like a sort of Fahrenheit 451 kind of a thing set in the real world. It's
more of a dandelion wine sort of a thing.
It is. In fact, it is almost a... now, do you like dandelion wine?
I do.
Okay. Because that's a book unlike a lot of Ray Bradbury's other stuff, because he's very sort of real world sometimes. It's like a twin book almost. It's like the nighttime version of Dandelion Wine. It just... it follows a group of boys on Halloween night where they get ready to trick-or-treat. And they notice that their friend... and I'm not giving anything away. This is just the basic setup. They get ready to trick or treat, and they notice their friend Pippin is gone, and it basically they spend it is over the course of one Halloween night as they try to find their friend Pippin, who has vanished, and an otherworldly figure appears to accompany them on their journey as they try to find what has happened to their vanished friend, and it's just beautiful. And the way that Bradbury does it, he actually leads you through the not the entire, but a more or less complete history of humans and how they have dealt with and approached death over the years. Everything from the Egyptians to the Day of the Dead to Western celebrations of Halloween over the course of this one story. So it's like a weird like history lesson meets like adventure meets like boo sort of a thing. But there is an animated version narrated by Bradbury that I have not yet watched. I'm waiting for the perfect evening. Speaking of which, since
you're paying for it by the night, you better make that evening soon.
And I was going to do it last night because I didn't get this done. And then we really have to end the show because we've been here for like everybody's got a whiz, and I got to go home and eat my cookie. But also, last night I very nearly decorated for Halloween, and I got behind with a bunch of stuff, and I was just up late working and things. I didn't get a chance. So tonight,
I'm always decorated for Halloween.
You really are. So you don't have to do anything. You basically just have to put a thing on the front door, and you're all set. But I got like all this, you know, all my crap is in the basement. I got two huge collections of boxes, one for Halloween and one for Christmas, and F everything else. And so I got all of my Halloween stuff, including, you've seen it, that cast iron jack-o'-lantern.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that thing weighs like 1,000 pounds. It's like every year
I say, oh, yeah, like I've been to your house. No, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, because we've had it in the last couple of radio stations I've worked at, we've put it in the lobby at Halloween time.
No.
See, and the thing is, I want to bring it in here. It's seriously, you'll love it. You'll go nuts for it.
Okay.
But it's just a huge jack-o'-lantern made of it's like welded. Anyway, it's freaking awesome. I don't know where to put it, though. There's really nowhere in here to put it. If I put it in the kitchen, it's going to take up the whole table. If I put it up on the roof, Lara's like, well, put it up because you put a candle inside of it and whatever. She's like, put it on the roof. And I'm like, well, if I put it on the roof in a place where it can scare people, that'll be a place where it's going to fall and kill someone as well.
Well, if we move the Slap Chop and the Vuvuzela and the Dennis Miller, there might be room.
Hey, you know, we can actually do that. We could do that and just say it's for Halloween and then never put the other stuff back.
I like that idea.
And the thing is, it would actually fit right there where that Slap Chop
is.
There
you go.
We would just say it's a little bit of color for Halloween. Mm-hmm. I'm going to bring it in tomorrow. So I got all of this stuff in the bay. I did put out I'm a big fan of cast iron stuff, a cast iron owl candle that hangs in front of the house. So, but I like boxes.
Do you dress
boxes.
Up your dogs for Halloween? Do you get them the little Halloween costumes?
I have tried, and by I mean Lara has tried, like four Halloweens in a row. She would buy Max. And it's like, here's the thing. The dog isn't rejecting the costume aesthetically. The dog just doesn't want to set a thing on his head.
Yeah.
And so after the first time, I'm like, it's never going to work. Like, you've tried the wizard costume. Give up. But then it's like, we have like a witch costume and we have like a pirate costume and she has like a zombie costume. Because every year she's like, Max will love this costume. And I'm like, you're giving the dog too much. He's a dog. He's not rejecting it because he doesn't feel he's a witch inside. He's more of a warlock. He doesn't want anything on his head. And so you put it, and then it was like sad where she was putting it on and then trying to hold him still long enough to get a photo. And he's immediately like pawing at the thing, like, get this cape off of me. And then she got this one cape that he was unable to tear off. And so then he just sat there and just looked sad and pissed off. Where he was just like, you know, are you going to let her emasculate me by putting me in like a strawberry shortcake outfit? So now her whole thing is to try to put it on Philo. But the thing is, Philo is just going to be afraid of it. So we've got. So if you want some like dog costumes, that they're too small
well, they're
for
too
your
small
dog.
Too small for my dog.
It'd be for your cat or whatever, because it's like I know how cats love to be dressed up.
Oh yeah, cats love to be dressed. The fun thing about putting clothes on cats is that anything you put on a cat, they try to back out of it.
Yeah.
So then they just start walking backwards around the room as if they can back out of their clothes.
They're just
which is kind of hilarious, really.
And as you're putting it on, they're like, no, you know.
Yeah.
They're sitting in a cupboard at home. They're just sitting there, having paid for them, you know. Doing nothing. So.
Bella will wear the clothes, but she doesn't want anything on her head. And so, like, one Christmas, I tried to put a Santa hat on her to get her picture taken at Petco with the Santa, and it just... She would not leave the damn thing on her head.
Yeah,
so.
No, it's you really do realize why the Grinch eventually just has to staple his the antlers or whatever to Max's head or whatever his dog is. All right, well, we should probably end this program now. We don't have to, but we probably should.
We probably should.
So forth. Join us tomorrow when our guests will include Ms. Kelly Clark from Willamette Week. Tomorrow we'll also have another installment of the greatest songs ever made. And... just because time constraints, if nothing else, I'll play this John Lennon thing tomorrow, I think will quite like. Thursday, we'll be joined by Mr. Bill Carter, author of Fools Rush In, and listener Jenny Hieronymus, who will count down the top five Pearl Jam songs you're a dick if you don't like. And Friday, maybe I'm just thinking that we have something on Friday because we usually do. But you know, Friday is Friday. So after a brief musical interlude, we'll have an encore edition of today's Legion of News, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program, and so forth. I was going to make some observation about people listening on the stream and listening online, but do not forget, since we've been talking about so much Halloween stuff, don't forget our Geek-O-Lantern carving contest, which is a bit of a mouthful, but the Geek-O-Lantern contest is happening right now, so I don't know when, like, pumpkins are available or whatever.
They're available now, apparently. Several people popped in to say that you can actually start buying them
awesome.
Right now.
So you carve a pumpkin or what have you in some geek fashion. You send it into us at contest@rickemerson.com. That's contest. @rickemerson.com. Send us a picture of your Geek-O-Lantern carving, and the top few folks will come into the studio, and we'll have a variety of nice prizes from thinkgeek.com, where if you use the code Emerson all this month, you'll get yourself a discount as well. So that is the Geek-O-Lantern contest. It's contest@rickemerson.com, and we'll post all those as they come in. All right. On that note, thank you for listening. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you today live, as it does every day from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district in beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, it is Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill. There's a hateful sun outside. Executive producer Bruce Agler and chief of staff is Cheryl Kenneco. We have an encore of Legion of News in this program next. As always, the Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you. This is all true. It is Tuesday, October 5th, rather, 2010, Geektober, sorry, and thank you for listening, and that is The Frequency, Kenneth. My name is Rick Emerson. See you all tomorrow. Be safe. Bye now.